to Reveal is back, and this time it's better than ever. We're giving away over 100,000 prizes, including three new Fiat 500 cars. Buy any slice and peel a tab for your chance to win. Ciao, I'm Dominic Primucci, inviting you to taste the difference.
439-444-PIZZA-NOVA. This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Well, happy long weekend. It's a happy Thanksgiving up here in Canada. People getting set, either listening, heading up north or somewhere, or sitting back listening, watching Primetime Sports. Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt on the Sportsnet Radio Network, watching on Sportsnet 360 as well. And we will talk NFL football in a few minutes' time. John Clayton, the regular visitor. Nick Alberga, he is my new co-host on all the Toronto Maple Leaf broadcasts on The Fan. And then we get the round table together, and it's a very august group we have, that Gordon Stellick, Stephen Brunt. Gord Stellick,
yeah,
Stephen
Brunt.
Yeah,
who's that? Hang on a second.
Yes, Elliot Friedman and Michael Grange will be joining. We'll talk about a number of things, including, Stephen, this is the last primetime sports show. Tim and Sid get underway. We're excited about that on Monday. And it is, who knows if it'll reemerge again or not, but, I mean, it's like been about a three-decade type ride.
Well, it has. Like, I never say never about things reemerging, because sure. You, yeah. God knows. But let's assume that this is the end of the line. It's a 30-plus year run. I think I first dipped my toe into this about 20 years ago, maybe a little more than that even. So, mm-hmm. You know, I was in and out, as you know.
Yes, yes.
I was in exile for a stretch.
It was like a soap opera.
Yeah.
The relationships. Yeah.
So none of that was my doing. But anyway, I was an innocent party. I was just being blown by the wind. But now you know, and again, there are not many people who, you know the full history of this thing, but we're going to do a Friday roundtable today. The Friday roundtable is actually, you know, it's not a recent edition, but it's a relatively, it was the Monday roundtable, was the classic roundtable.
Correct. The Monday roundtable, and I believe, and you, if you can correct me, but Bob would talk about, it was when Ben Johnson happened, the controversy in 1988, and Wayne Parrish, I think, was co-hosting.
And Brian Williams.
Brian Williams, yep. Then came on, and they made a whole roundtable about it. So they did the Monday roundtable. It was going fine. I'm there doing the big show before Bob,
yes,
and filling in on Primetime Sports. So Damian Cox,
yes,
who he and Mary Ormsby were day oneers at The Fan, and then in a ill-informed decision or construed decision, whoever was the sports editor decided he didn't want them on radio.
At the Toronto Star.
At the Toronto Star.
Yes.
So Mary
went off. One of those great decisions. That's why newspapers are dying, by the way.
Exactly.
Stuff like
exactly.
That.
Yeah. Why would you want not want someone out there promoting it all the time? So we had to think of a little role for Damian. So on the big show on Fridays, we did the show called The Cutting Edge.
Yes.
And he hosted it. It was a two-hour roundtable.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he got big again and went to Primetime Sports, he stole it.
Well,
it was stolen. I call it the bastardized version of The Cutting Edge is what the Friday roundtable became. So I'm happy this puppy is being, you know, put away, because you guys stole it from me.
Well, that's right.
The guy that invented Coke and the other guy stole it. Yeah.
When Damian was around, I would always refer to it to him. And I'm actually going to see him tonight. So
okay.
I'll remind him of this. I referred to it as your dead show, because because it was like they killed the show in the afternoon, and then it moved and it morphed into the Friday version of Primetime
yes.
Sports, right? And the 2-hour roundtable came from that. But yeah, my main memory of the former Damian show was that he used to give out gift certificates, right? That was the deal you get. And Saul Cormen, people have been hearing Saul's ads.
569, Danforth.
So you'd get these, you know, among other things, you would get these Saul Cormen gift certificates,
yeah.
And they were for a very small amount of money. But I just collected them, right? I got a stack of them.
Yeah.
And then one day I went into Saul's place with this huge stack of now,
did he turn green when he saw them all?
He wasn't that thrilled, I got to say. You know, I thought he'd be more friendly, but I don't think he. That was the way he thought it was going to work. I think he thought it was going to work that you came in and, you know, you took $50 off your pair of socks or something. But in fact, I brought like a year's worth. So I still didn't get a heck of a lot for it, I got to tell you. But That's my main memory of that show were gift certificates. But there were some pretty heated discussions on those shows.
Yeah, and the roundtables will continue.
Yes.
With you, Jeff, and Richard as well.
We're going to do a Monday roundtable, I believe. Now, I probably shouldn't, give away too much, but I can give away anything I want. But when we start, I don't know what we're doing on, we will work the holiday Monday, so we will be here on the 2 to 5. But yeah, we're going to do a Monday, a 1 hour Monday roundtable, which actually, again, that is the classic version.
Mondays suit it. Mondays are the best day. You've had the weekend, you've had 2 days off. That's what I found. So
yeah, and I have fond memories of, it was a three person show. So it was Bob and whoever his co-host was. I used to do it. I did it with Shaky a lot with Jim Hunt. So, and you would be I would be the third guy on a Monday. And that's really how I got into radio. That's the first radio I ever did.
First time I was on Primetime Sports, it was general manager of the Leafs, and it was Bob McCowan and Bill Waters were the co-hosts. And the Fan wasn't even an all-sports station then. And then as it became an all-sports station, that, of course, was a staple. And you mentioned, God rest his soul, Jim Shaky Hunt. And we are doing an Argo segment in the Friday roundtable because Shaky would want that.
We'll dedicate that segment to Shake. I miss him.
And then we had, and the other part is, I can remember chatting with you. You and I, you were in the, as they said, we're an ink-stained wretch.
Yes.
And I was a unemployed hockey executive turned broadcaster.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, the 90s were, a lot of freelance gigs could happen. And we'd be competing for the same extra thing. TSN would have shows Saturday, Sunday, like the John Wells show Sunday morning.
Yeah.
There'd be...
That turned into the reporters eventually with Dave Hodge.
Yeah, well, but Wells had his sports desk, whatever show. Then Monday morning would be Canada AM, so you got on that panel.
I had a few of those, I did that with Shake until he got fired the second time.
So that paid $125, right?
That's pretty good,
Then Steve Paikin at TVO, you could make another $125 Monday night.
Studio, too. I had a long run on that. Mary Armsby did that for a long time.
We were all fighting for the same. And you'd be checking your voicemail at home to see if they called. You seem to be on the A-list, but I'd be like, a guy named Corey Russell would call about one show, or Richard Martin would call on behalf of Steve Paikin, and you go,
absolutely.
Oh, good. I'm doing those things. So, and I forget who would call me off Canada, but it was all kind of fractured that way. And then it's come together now with the sports TV networks being the be all and end all when it comes to sports.
Yeah, well, the beauty of it, there are a bunch of guys around who needed the dough.
Yeah.
It's what it came down to, right? And, it was a time, like, when I think of the roundtable, it's different now, but a lot of what a lot of the people featured on there were newspaper people, right?
Yeah.
And the beauty of newspaper people was, A, they were available, B, they worked cheap, and C, but they actually went out and did stuff, right?
Yeah.
They went places, did things, covered stuff, talked to people, and had kind of firsthand knowledge of the sports world, and that's what they brought to the table a lot of the time. So, it's kind of gone now. It's unfortunate that has shrunk, and it's not just that it shrunk, that the people who work for newspapers now don't have the same opportunity to go places and do things. The baseball postseason's on. I'm trying to think of anybody, other than our folks on the broadcast side are covering it from Canada right now. Normally that would be something that everybody would send someone to the baseball postseason. Right?
Well, and when the Fan started as an all-sports station, whether it's primetime sports or anything else, there were some established writers that wouldn't come on, right? Or wanted big dough. And then there were others, and I'll use you and Damien as but guys that understood it, and women. And it really helped. I hate that word brand, but it really helped your brand. You know what I mean?
You're right.
You guys were good at it, and it really grew that way. Then a lot of you, it became your full-time gig.
Well, we didn't think of it. We didn't think of the brand thing.
That's not why you went into it.
I started as the sports columnist of the Globe and Mail, the main columnist in 1989, right? So that's a long time ago, and I was, really new in the business in some ways, but I was especially new in sports. You thought, well, that's the best gig in the country, right? I'm the sports columnist of the Globe and Mail. What else do I want to do? I don't want to do the other stuff. But it became, I think we all started to understand that whatever your platform was, whether it was the Toronto Star or the Toronto Sun or the Globe and Mail or later on the National Post, whatever your platform was, it was limited, right? And you realized that there were people, it started to dawn on you that there were people who only knew of your existence because you went on with Bob McCowan, right? That they knew of the people who didn't ever read you in the paper.
Yeah.
Especially with the Globe, right? Which is, had a kind of a specific readership. There's a whole sports audience out there that never read me, but they got to know, and I think Damien said absolutely the same thing with Damien, got to know us through radio and eventually through television and these gigs. yeah, look, if we'd been plotting something out, that would have been the way to do it. But again, no one thought of it in those days. We, you know, there was no social media. I don't do that anyway. But if you wanted to kind of build your name recognition, at least that was the way to do it. And this platform, you know, Drive Time in Toronto and nationally, because that was the other thing. It wasn't just people in Toronto that would pick it up. You know, the network meant something in those days, and the show was popping up all across the country.
Yeah, I also look back when you talk about primetime sports was, you know, I was doing some Leaf games on radio. I had picked up some other things. I was doing that ringside American Hockey League magazine show. So all of a sudden these media things were morphing a bit. I was still looking to possibly get back on the management side, and I filled in for Bill Waters for 2 weeks, and I co-hosted primetime sports in the summer, and I really liked it. And they thought I did whatever well meant, you know, I later became more the host guy than the analyst guy, but I really enjoyed the 2 weeks and it was the great experience. Then all of a sudden when the Fan got launched, this is just before the Fan launched, I was included in the mix at the start. Then I did the show with Damian for a few years and then the big show for many years after that. But it was, I think a lot of people, this was a great show to cut your teeth on.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely, and you know, look, this show, and you know, again, if we're going to lay this last version of it to rest tonight, but this show, you know, Primetime Sports, became known for being able to go into a lot of different places, mm-hmm. right? It wasn't about kind of the necessarily about last night's game as much as it was about bigger issues sometimes, a lot of some business, you know, pioneered kind of talking about sports as a business. We dealt a lot with labor issues because of the strikes in baseball and the lockouts in hockey. It could handle pretty reasonably heavy kind of newsy stuff as well as, you know, who won and who lost.
Now, saying that, I will just tell you, I'm really looking forward to the mixture of you, Jeff, and Richard. And that thing won't disappear. And certainly Tim and Sid are guys that have done radio yes. and TV.
Oh, absolutely.
That will also bring that. So as
yeah,
we,
no, that's yeah. right. No, and look, I love working with Tim and Sid.
Yeah.
I've had loads of fun doing stuff with those guys and it's a great show. I think, you know, Blair hosting with either me or Richard, co-hosting starting at 2 to 5, it's going to be interesting just in terms of the clock. I'm trying to figure out what my life is going to feel like being in here. It's been a long time since I've never done that slot.
Yeah.
I think we'll do that show. Will be a hybrid of what Jeff was doing 9 to 12.
Yeah.
I co-hosted with him for quite a long stretch on that show and Primetime Sports. So I think you're going to, you know, the idea is to draw on three guys who, you know, all come from the sports writing world,
mm-hmm.
Different places in some ways and in different things. We've covered different stuff, but to draw on our experience and, you know, that's going to be our stock and trade.
The reemergence of the reporters. How about that?
Well, who knows?
Yes.
Go.
The columnists. That's what we'll have. Looking forward to that. And we always draw on the NFL expertise. John Clayton, of course, a guy who knows his National Football League action from ESPN Seattle, joining Gord Stellick and Stephen Brunt this afternoon for his regular Friday visit. How are you, John?
Good. How are you?
We're good. We're good. Actually, your regular Thursday visit now on a Friday. So it all works out well. And you know something, John, 1 week into the NHL hockey season, and you're prefacing everything with, I know it's early, but, and we'll be doing that with basketball soon. At what point do you shed that in the National Football League that if a team that should be 4-1 is 1-4, whatever, that you stop saying, I know it's early, but?
Well, it used to be probably, you know, week 4 or week 5, but with such limited action in the preseason, now I think you stretch it out to week maybe 7, maybe week 8, because sometimes it does take half the season to be able to figure out who's good and who's bad. And you see it every year. And, of course, you have to also look at the competition and how it's going to be because, for example, what you have is that, a bad AFC right now. So you can be one of the Denver Broncos at 1-4. You might be able to bounce back and still be able to do it because there's just not many good teams in the AFC. If you were doing this in the NFC, you could forget it. That just wasn't going to happen.
I'm going to start with the bad, if that's okay. Somebody's going to win. Washington's playing Miami this weekend. Someone will win. You could have a tie.
You still have a tie, yeah.
But John, I want to ask you about the Washington football team. You know, they fired Jay Gruden. You know, the Daniel Snyder era is, it is what it is. But how do you rebuild that franchise? How do you rebuild credibility in that franchise Where do they go? Because, you know, this, if this isn't the bottom, it feels pretty darn close to the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a matter quarterback, and then, you know, you try to get the rest of the roster to equal the quarterback. And I think that they got a good young quarterback in Dwayne Haskins. It's just that he's not ready yet. And so with that in mind, what you have to try to do is, build some credibility and win, because obviously winning solves everything. And right now this team's not set to win. I mean, you look at the offensive line, it's a mess. You look at the defense, it's a disappointment. And so, and then of course you've got guys like Trent Williams who just don't even want to be there. And he's one of the best players in the team. So what you have to do is hope that Bill Callahan can do something. You got Kevin O'Connell, Connor, who's the offensive coordinator. I mean, if you can at least, you know, get today 6 wins, which right now is probably not going to happen, but if you can get to 6 wins, you might have enough credibility to hand it over to him. But, you know, what you got to do is that you've got to try to turn harder on the players, because I think you can see that maybe Jay was a little bit too light on the players as far as the demands, because Bill Callahan has really pushed them hard in practice this week.
Do you think there are issues higher up, though? You know, again, if I'm a fan of that team, like a lot of the enmity is going to be being directed at Daniel Snyder and to a degree at Bruce Allen. Is that where the issue lies?
I mean, probably to a certain degree, but again, not the whole degree. I mean, you know, you always have to put the owner in the one spot, because if there's a long history of lack of success, then it's always going to go on the owner. And sometimes it's unfair with the general manager or even the president of the team, the CEO, to put it on him. But, you know, you can see that, you know, Dan Snyder has had a lack of success in a lot of the things so far in his 2 decades of owning the team. He cares. He's a former season ticket holder. He wants to win, and he's willing to put whatever resources into doing it. But whatever he's doing as far as the decision making, just something's amiss.
Yeah. Well, the owner as fan, you know, is a tricky one. In Jerry Jones' case, you got almost the owner as general manager in some ways, right? You have a guy who, you know, gets very involved in personnel, but that model. I wonder in the modern National Football League, people kind of maybe roll their eyes at the last part of the Al Davis era, but he was very successful early on, and he was a football guy who was the owner. But I'm wondering, John, if that can work now. If an owner has to stay away, if they really need to back off and let the football people do the football stuff.
Well, I mean, it depends on the owner. I mean, for example, I mean, Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones, I mean, they have such a voice in everything. And I mean, except for the last 2 games, they've done a great job of building that team up. And, you know, you need the right personnel people to make the decision, because obviously the owner is not going to be, unless it's Al Davis, going to be the one that can judge the players like a personnel guy can. But I think what you can see is that, Jerry is one that you can see success. I mean, he did get Dak Prescott. You look at that roster and it's loaded with great talent, both on offense and defense. It's just now in the last 2 weeks played off. But, sometimes you get to the point where you maybe meddle a little bit too much. And so that's where Jerry has to pull back a little bit, because, you know, you see that, he's won 1 playoff game in, 3 decades? Yeah. Or since Jimmy Johnson left and Barry Switzer kind of filled in. But, you really should let the football people make the football decisions. But, again, you own the team. It's the golden rule. The man with the gold, he gets the rule.
Yeah, although I guess you need a – sorry, you know, you mentioned Jimmy Johnson, like having that strong counterpoint there. Like, I feel for Jason Garrett because I don't know that Jason Garrett's going to survive there. What do you think? You know, again, Jason Garrett is perpetually on the hot seat. He's on the hot seat, especially, again, after these last 2 weeks. Is he going to survive?
Well, I mean, they want him to survive. Jerry does, because he's a coach that's not going to raise any issues on personnel. If Jerry brings in players he doesn't like, Jason's not going to say anything. He's just going to try to coach him up. So from that standpoint, I mean, this is the easiest way for Jerry to do what Jerry wants to do. Same thing for Steven. And so what you now got to see is that if they don't make the playoffs with the talent that they have, you can probably anticipate there is going to be a change. I mean, remember, this is a guy that wanted to give Jason Garrett an extension, but because they only won 1 playoff game during his tenure, they haven't done it yet. And if they don't make the playoffs, then he's not going to get an extension whatsoever.
John Clayton joining Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt, Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network. And we talk about iconic franchises that way, John, that I can go remember the Cleveland Browns of Bill Nelson and Leroy Kelly and Paul Warfield and all that when they were on TV, the Giants were on TV, the Cowboys. So you didn't see a lot of teams initially. You can see them all. You have been able to for decades. And those were the old Cleveland Browns. How come the current Cleveland Browns, no matter what it is, they are what really like the LA Clippers were for so many years? Even when there was optimism the start of the season, it just doesn't seem to happen.
Well, and this is where because again, you look to the owner, Jim Haslam. I mean, he's probably done more one-and-done coaches in his tenure than you can see in years. And there's a lack of stability on the team. Now, he made a great move in getting John Dorsey as the general manager, and you can see that John's got the talent on the team. But did they make the right decision in the head coach? Here's Freddie Kitchens, a running back coach at the beginning of last year. And at this stage, I mean, he hasn't shown with the play calling, with his way he runs the team, that he's ready to be the one for the job. And so coaches a lot of time are judged with how well they handle adversity. Well, the problem is, you know, the 30-point loss in Tennessee against Tennessee at home at the beginning of the season, you know, that wasn't countered. You know, you can see that they bounce back each up and down each week. The offensive line is not very good, and is it well coached? Hard to tell. So, and a disappointment right now in Baker Mayfield. I mean, after scoring 22.4 points a game last year, is now scoring 14.4 and only completing 55% of his passes. It's a mess right now.
How much of that is, you know, again, the focus is going to be on Baker Mayfield, and Baker Mayfield brings a lot of the focus on himself. That's the nature of the guy. But, you know, you mentioned that offensive line being, you know, somewhere between mediocre and awful. What do you think with the Baker Mayfield you have seen this season? What do you think, John?
Well, I think what it comes down to is that the situations, and again, this is where the play calling may be a little bit different, because he's throwing longer passes, but they're less percentage completion passes. He's trying to get the ball downfield, and then of course, you've now had a year to study him, and so they're forcing him to go right where he's not great throwing right on the run. That's been a problem. They've had eight holding penalties, 10 false starts. They've had four other offensive blocking penalties and 16 sacks allowed. So you now have too many second and 15s, third and 15s, and he's been running out of those formations, believe it or not. And so it looks to me that they're just out of sync. They're basically, the mistakes internally are killing them and putting Baker in a position where he just can't get the completions there. And this is even after getting Odell Beckham Jr.
Yeah. So it's kind of hard to, like, putting it on his shoulders. And again, that's a natural thing for fans to do, for sure. And again, he invites attention, but it's more of a, it's a more complex failure than just Baker Mayfield being in over his head. Is it not?
Oh, you would think so, yeah. I mean, because there's so much. And then also, it's like, okay, so they add Olivier Vernon in the trade, and they sign Sheldon Richardson, and they're giving up 5.2 yards a carry. Figure that one out.
Yeah.
On the Buffalo Bills side, I don't know if it quite exercised what happened in Tennessee so many years ago in the playoffs, but I really couldn't believe they won that game the other day when it looked like Tennessee had scored a touchdown or then a field goal or what have you. Are you bullish on the Bills at all, or will, like the few times they've had great starts before, they'll come back to earth?
Well, the thing is that, again, AFC versus NFC, it's so different. What you can see is they had a 360 schedule, the easiest in football, and they're winning these games. And that was a good win on the road to Tennessee. And the way they're constructed right now produces the chance for them to win, because you look around the AFC, you see so many young quarterbacks that are going to make mistakes, allow a team like Buffalo to win the turnover battle, and then you'll win some low-scoring games. Josh Allen, I still think, is a year away from being pretty decent. I don't think he's there yet. But when you look at the schedule and the fact that they're in a AFC East, that you can get two wins against the Jets and two wins against Miami, and you look at the other teams that they're playing, it's like these are all winnable games. And because they got a defense that's going to give up less than 20 points, they're in every game. And so I think they're kind of built the way that the AFC is to steal wins that they wouldn't be able to steal if they were in the NFC.
Yeah, they look like a playoff team, don't they, John? So like, with this, given the schedule and kind of given where they are right now,
They're a playoff team, even though they're probably not a playoff team as far as, the talent level and everything else. But this is where I give them credit, because, you look at the Jets and they outspent everybody in free agency with Le'Veon Bell and CJ Mosley and all that stuff. They're 0-4 and 0-4 looking terrible. Where you look at the Bills, they spent the third most amount of money, but they spent it on a lot of players. And got 16 players in unrestricted free agency, so they have better depth, so they can handle injuries better. So I think that they've done a better model of trying to build up. Both teams have young quarterbacks, Sam Darnold with the Jets, and you got Josh Allen with the Bills. I think Darnold's better, but right now, Josh is enjoying the easy schedule and having better depth.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, the undefeated San Francisco 49ers, not something a lot of people probably thought they'd be saying at this point in the season. For real or not for real, John, what do you think?
Well, they're definitely going to win the AFC North. I mean, they've won three games against AFC North teams, so I think one more win and they clinch it. But they're in the NFC West.
Yeah.
And really, we'll find out this weekend. Now, again, they've played well. They're outscoring teams by two touchdowns a game. But, again, haven't played a winning team yet. Now they play the Rams. Now they get the break that Todd Gurley's not going to be there. But here's the warning that I have on the 49ers. Where I thought that they were going to be the most improved team in football, and right now they're in that direction, injuries are going to play a factor with them. So what happened on Sunday? They win 31-3. They lose Mike McClinchy, their right tackle. They lose their fullback, Kyle Justice, and then of course they end up losing a week ago Arturo Witherspoon, the cornerback, and so now you're down a right tackle, a left tackle because Joe Staley's hurt. You lost your fullback, and so injuries are going to knock them down, just like they did last year. But they're a better team than they were last year. But again, these injuries are going to play a big factor.
Well, looking forward to Week 6. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks very much, John.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, John.
John Clayton, of course, ESPN Sports in Seattle. When we come back, it'll be the new voice, co-voice with yours truly for all the Toronto Maple Leaf action. Leafs Nation co-host Nick Alberga will join us. By the way, you can win the weekly $500 prize pack and qualify for our grand prize Toronto Sports Weekend Getaway with the VTech Wake Up Call Contest. Give us a call at 416-413-4141. Leave us your best Toronto sports take. And starting next week, set your alarms to 8:20 a.m. every Friday morning for the VTech Wake Up Call on Leadoff with Ashley, Ziggy, and Scotty Mack. Visit sportsnet.ca/590 for details. Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt, the Roundtable 2 later on with Elliot Friedman and Michael Grange at the top of the hour. But Nick Alberga joins us next. This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network and watching on Sportsnet 360.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Welcome back, Primetime Sports. Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt, the Roundtable in about 20 minutes' time. Elliot Friedman, Michael Grange will be here. And look forward to chatting about many, many things, including a little Primetime Sports history on our last show. But many, many Toronto Maple Leaf games and broadcasts ahead on the Fan Radio Network. And I don't think, have you met Nick before, Stephen?
I do not believe I have.
Yeah, it's be a big thrill, big thrill. So we're doing it on the phone first. So next time the in-person, he is larger than life.
Okay.
But now officially the co-host along with yours truly for all Leafs Nation broadcasts. So involving doing pre-games, intermissions, post-games. And of course, after every game, there's always Leafs Nation post-game. He'll be involved in panels and appearances here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. And Nick Alberga joining Gord Stellick and Stephen Brunt. So Nick, Brunt was asking me about, I said, you've been there at the start of the season, but you kept making jokes about your tryout. You're on a PTO, and now it's official.
Yeah, exactly it. I was actually making jokes for the last couple of weeks that I was on a PTO, but certainly I'm thrilled to be signing this deal with Sportsnet and look forward to the future. And it's also a pleasure to be on the final primetime for this iteration, at least, and to speak to both of you.
And Stephen, I made him nervous on the tryout too. I gave up nothing, right, Nick?
Yeah, that's it.
He was looking for assurances. Yeah, anyway, it's been fun. It's going to be great working with you. And of course, you're hosting, and I'm doing the analyst part and analyze what we saw last night. Really, the last, it's a great Toronto Maple Leaf team in the big picture, but not a great week.
It was not pretty, and suffice to say, we did handle that on the post-game, Leafs Nation post-game yesterday. Certainly, you look at that first period, and this is sort of a theme with this Maple Leafs team the last couple of years, is slow starting in terms of defensive structure. I think as this month goes on into November, they're going to get more instituted defensively. Let's not forget the roster turnover, guys. There's been a lot of newcomers coming into this lineup and a lot of guys playing prolific roles coming into this lineup. And also the bottom six is a lot different than we saw last year. So I think it's going to take some time to gel. The good news and the positive thing is that the Leafs are not the only team struggling defensively. Just look at what the Washington Capitals did last night against the Nashville Predators at Bridgestone. It seems to be a league-wide thing every October, save a couple teams who have been hot out of the gates where they really, really struggle from a defensive standpoint. Not to mention as well, you look at that game, not to make excuses, but the Lightning were coming in off a poor performance, I would say, on Sunday against Carolina. They got Braden Point back into the lineup. That probably got them going a bit too. But it is unacceptable what the captain, John Tavares, said. Unacceptable. You surrender 7 goals on home ice. He is correct in that.
Yeah, well, it's if Freddie Anderson's going to be left bare like that, you know, too many nights, it's really, Nick, how much is he going to have to? You talked about the kind of gelling early. How much are they going to have to rely on Freddie Anderson to kind of patch things over until they gel?
In my honest opinion, way too much. Yeah. I still have my, you know, ideas of what I think the backup goaltending situation should be. We all know the cap situation by now, guys. I mean, this is nothing on Michael Hutchinson, but I'm not sure he's good enough to be a backup goalie in the NHL. And that's just being fair about it. Like, in the first game, Gordon and I discussed, you know, he was pretty good. Still let a couple of softies in, as we know, against Montreal. And the Habs came back and stormed back there in the third period. And sometimes you need that save. Not to say that, you know, Frederik Andersen has made that save, but in the past, he's been accustomed to doing so. And I just wonder if Michael Hutchinson, if we're talking two months down the road, if he's still the backup goalie, because certainly we look back a year at this time, the Leafs had a couple options to be the backup, namely the guy, ironically enough, was the backup for Tampa last night, and that's Curtis McElhinney. So if you had to pick at sort of straws at this scenario and look at this Maple Leafs team, I think they're really, really strong. But I think one of the negatives as the season continues is trying to find a way to keep the workload down when it comes to Frederik Anderson, for sure.
I mentioned, you know what was weird last night, Stephen, and Nick and I have talked about it, on air, in last night's game. So you're playing the President's Trophy team after playing the Stanley Cup champions. And, of course, the Stanley Cup finalists were the Boston Bruins. And the game last night reminded me of that Game 6, the Sunday afternoon game against Boston, where the Leafs had the best chance to put the Bruins out.
Yep.
They were up 1-0. And remember that, Nick, and all the momentum. Mm-hmm. And then they got some chintzy penalties, and they couldn't kill them off. Bruins scored twice. They screwed up on a faceoff when Zach Hyman was out there. Same thing last night. A couple of chintzy penalties, Kapanen and Jason Spezza. The momentum goes. Marner gets killed on a faceoff, and all of a sudden, it was almost like that a repeat of what we saw, better in a regular season game than in a playoff game this time, Nick.
It was, and I think bottom line, when push comes to shove, and, you know, we see it more times than not, look at St. Louis, look at Boston, look at Washington, all the elite teams from the last couple of years, you need your big guys to step up when it matters most. You know, John Tavares, Mitch Marner, Austin Matthews, Willie Nylander, especially in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Again, we can't forget this bottom six is a lot different, but you need to kill that clutch penalty. And certainly I think it comes down to goal scoring, as you know, and in the playoffs, the clutch factor. You know, Gord is beside himself yesterday about Mitch Marner taking a couple draws in the D zone on the PK. I get it. I mean, I think they are still tinkering with some stuff at this point in time. So far, Mike Babcock has put a lot of you know, trust into his third line with Mikhaev, Kerfoot, and more. Personally, I still don't think he has any idea what he wants to do with the fourth line aside from Frederik Gauthier, who seems to be a mainstay in this lineup. It looks like Nick Shore and Dmytro Timoshov are going to go back in the lineup on Saturday in Detroit. But certainly, I think when it comes down to the important factors in a season, they got to find a way to bear down. That's the biggest key for me for this team this season.
Spezza had a tough night last night. And if his name was Joe Smith, and partially he's kind of playing in the shadow of the guy he used to be, right?
Yeah.
It's always, you know, that focus maybe is unfair on him.
But we saw the glimmer against St. Louis, that nice hand-eye coordination on the goal. Yep. But you're right, last night was a tough night.
But if he was another guy playing on the fourth line, you know, you wouldn't be saying, well, the reason they lost last night is because of Jason Spezza. But, you know, he's almost in an impossible situation here, it seems.
Yeah, but you know what happened? And Nick and I have talked about it. It's weird because they signed him here. Then it sounded like Mike Babcock thought he got a bad eHarmony date or something. Like it just, right? Like,
oh,
just,
yeah,
like just all of a sudden for a couple of days of training camp, it's like, this wasn't who I hooked up with online. So that, I think Nick, that's what's added to maybe the debate that way, because any morsel in Toronto gets beaten up a bit. But the fact he sort of brought Spezza to task in preseason was a little baffling given his reverence for veteran players.
Yeah, it's like lost in translation. It's like they told Jason Spezza he was going to play another role when they signed him, and that changed. And I get it. Before, you know, when they signed him, they hadn't made that trade to trade Kadri to the Colorado Avalanche. But I think he pretty much knew his defined role with this team. And I do think it's a lot to swallow, certainly for a guy on his previous contract, I think, was making, what, $7.5 million, although he had stepped to a lower role with the Dallas Stars the last couple of years. But it is really, really bizarre to me to see I don't want to call it a feud, but the back and forth so far when it comes to Mike Babcock and his doghouse, and having a guy with the pedigree and the resume that Jason Spezza has, but certainly I think watching the game last night, it's fair to say that Patan and Jason Spezza likely eating a popcorn press box coming up on Saturday, or maybe the pizza because it's Little Caesars Arena.
Well, let's talk. You're talking about guys in the twilight of their career. Well, you're just starting your burgeoning career. So Nick Elberga, I knew you from NHL Network Radio, and of course you worked here doing the network show on Saturdays around the National Hockey League. And you're a younger guy, everyone is compared to me right now. But so tell us a little about Nick Elberga, the hockey background, and who you were a fan of growing up.
Yeah, I actually left SiriusXM NHL Network Radio to get away from you, Gord. But somehow, by the powers that be, we're back together. I'm really, really pumped up to do this with you all season long. I'll be doing more fantasy hockey coverage as well on Sportsnet.ca, a couple of weekly articles, my weekly 20 thoughts. And we're also launching a digital fantasy hockey show that will be available across the Sportsnet platform alongside Andy McNamara, who comes over to the Sportsnet brand as well. So that's exciting time. To answer your question, I've been a Maple Leafs fan for as long as I can remember. I was actually born in Montreal, if you can believe it, but I'm not a Habs fan, so don't worry. I love the NHL in general, Gord, as you know, on a nightly, daily basis. That's all I'm doing is refreshing Twitter, looking at what's happening. So I've had a keen eye on this for a long, long time. I've been in the industry for about 10 years now. I'm another disciple of the College of Sports Media and also Fanshawe College. Shout out to them as well. It's been a fun journey, and it's also been crazy to see it all unfold over the last couple of years. And I'm excited about this venture, I won't lie, and also working with you, Gord.
Okay, the Twitter handle, at the Golden Muzzy. Did you steal that from Jake Muzzin, or what's the Golden Muzzy?
So everybody asked me this question, and believe it or not, Roger Lajoie, the great Roger Lajoie, taught me at the College of Sports Media about 11, 12 years ago.
Excuse me, the great Roger Lajoie? I love Roger. Okay, the great Roger Lajoie. I like to hear that. Okay.
So he taught me a new media class, and it was around the time where, you know, Twitter was starting to pick up steam. So essentially he said, hey, like, I think it'd be a smart idea for the entire class to make a Twitter handle. It was Movember. As you know, I normally have a beard, but I like doing the whole Movember thing and raising money for a great cause. And so my mustache comes in a little blonde, and I was like, why not the Golden Muzzy? And so fortunately or unfortunately, whatever way you look at it, it's stuck, and people call me Muzzy now, especially on NHL Network Radio, as you know. So I can't change it. It's been part of my brand. Of course, I released a podcast in August, aptly named Unmuzzled. So I've stuck with it, and it's sort of like a blessing. It's really bizarre how it worked out.
Well, it's worked out great for you and great for us here. So Nick, once again, as a full-time guy now, the PTO is over. Welcome aboard. I also look forward to all the Leafs games. We'll be back at it tomorrow night, post-game for Leafs Nation, post-game after the Detroit-Toronto game. And thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate this. Take care.
Nick Elberga, the new co-host on Leafs Nation.
Mm-hmm. Man, Tampa was flying last night.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
They scuffled, you know, and we were talking to somebody from Tampa this week just about them. That Carolina game was just was dreadful, right? And it's hard to look at that team last night and say, how did they, you know, how can you shut them down offensively? Well, they kind of shut themselves down offensively against Carolina, it sounds like. But that looked like the team that was the best team in the league for most of the year last year.
And when I do my keys to victory, I talked about it being the perfect storm, Stephen, in that another Stephen Stamkos spoke out after that Carolina game. They never had 1 second of adversity last year in the regular season. And I bet you John Cooper, looking back at it, says, geez, I wish there'd been something in the regular season so when it happened in the worst possible time in the playoffs, we could have drawn on it. So in this case, you had Stamkos calling them out. You had Braden Point coming back, and you had a team with 4 days off, and they're the best team in the NHL. St. Louis won the Stanley Cup last year, but no question, the best team body of work because of it wasn't just a President's Trophy team; it was one of the all-time great regular season runs.
Yeah, well, that's it, and it's funny. Like, winning the Stanley Cup is different than being the best team in the National Hockey League during the regular season. They are, right?
Yeah.
Different things. And St. Louis, won, especially the way St. Louis won that cup, it's almost a, you know, a victory of perseverance in a lot of ways, right?
That's right.
But in terms of talent, top to bottom, you know, these guys are the best team in the league right now, and they were the best team in the league last year.
Yeah, they would trade that President's Trophy for a Stanley Cup,
yes, though, they would.
Obviously,
oh, yes,
but
they would.
They certainly showed that last night. That'll be one of the topics that we'll talk about, the Toronto Maple Leafs. Also, NHL talk coming up. We will chat about, we got some baseball playoffs. Boy, did those game fives. I can't wait to talk about those. That was crazy. And we got kind of a good panel for our last Friday night Primetime Sports Roundtable. Elliot Friedman and Michael Grange will join us. You're listening to Primetime Sports. Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt. You're listening on the Sportsnet Radio Network. You're watching on Sportsnet 360. And we come back the last Friday. Primetime Sports Roundtable is next.
Oddshark.net is your source for the latest odds from leading authorities, expert editorial content, and detailed matchup picks. Looking for statistics and trends from an upcoming game? Oddshark.net has that too, and it's free.
It's free.
Expert in-depth analysis, stats, numbers, and trends to help you make the sharp game day picks.
Whether you want to get in on the football action,
tonight's baseball game, or anything in between, head over to Oddshark.net and start playing like a shark today. This is not a gambling site.
This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Welcome back, Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network and on Sportsnet 360. And Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt, joined for the last Friday roundtable by Michael Grange. And we'll Photoshop Elliot Friedman in the picture right now.
He's on his way.
He will be joining us shortly. Elliot always comes in anyway, kind of like a house on fire, like, you know, running late, in a hurry, doing a million things at the same time.
It's a little, well, there is again, if we're talking historic roundtable stuff, there are many instances of last-minute arrivals, people on cell phones, traffic stories, et cetera, et cetera. There's a long legacy of that. And it is, it's the Friday before a holiday weekend. Things are a little nuts out there right now.
Yeah,
people are trying
to
get, actually half this building, of course, no one else is working here now. You notice that, right?
Like that's who's on the road.
Just for the day.
Yeah, no, everybody was given a free pass for the afternoon here other than us. So
yeah, there was Anita giving a half day off, correct. which was
very nice. I'm sure they'll make it up to us at some point.
It said in the email that they would as well. And the last segment, we'll talk a little bit about Primetime Sports because so many people have been involved throughout the decades. And of course, Tim and Sid start up on Monday, and a lot of things will continue. Of course, Stephen being involved with Jeff and Richard Deitch as well. So a lot of great things in moving ahead, but your first time on Primetime Sports, do you remember?
I do. I have a vivid memory. Of course, I was also on for Bob's last show as well.
Yes.
That's right, you were here.
I mean, yep. I don't know, are we still allowed
you're
to
the closer.
Are we allowed to say Bob's name?
You're the Grim Reaper, buddy.
Yes, yeah. You're the true old-fashioned closer in baseball.
No, but I remember it vividly because it was the Raptors were in the midst of firing Kevin O'Neill. Mm-hmm. It was sort of at almost the peak of their dysfunction. And there was a lot of back and forth on what his potential would be and
Kevin O'Neill's potential.
What his fate was going to be and how it was going to be executed.
Around wrecking the hotel rooms and that
it was,
stuff.
Yeah, it was all out of that horrible season.
Yeah.
And so I was on air with, it was myself, Bob, and Dave Festjak of the Toronto Star. And I can't remember who the other person was. And it was all around this. I guess it was the day that Glenn Grunwald resigned as well, I think. Or was told, he was fired basically. And so in the hallway, in a break, one of those long 20-minute breaks, you know, I made the point of saying to Dave, you know, something you had in your column or your story at the time he wasn't a columnist, but you know, it wasn't right. I mean, I you know, because I know this is how it worked. That didn't go over very well. and Dave, who we're very good friends, and we've written a couple of books together and things, but at the time we were still a little more testosterone driven than we are now. And we basically always had a fight in the hallway. And Mike Gentile, who was the former producer way, way back, he kind of peeks in and says, guys, we should probably get back on air. And, oh, okay, okay. That was the best radio I've ever heard, though. and on we went. But it was, that's why I remember it. And, you know, like a lot of those schoolyard type things, Dave and I became pretty good friends out of it.
Well, we'll talk. You know, when you bring up Kevin O'Neill's name, I'm wondering when you.
I regret bringing up his name,
but
to be honest.
Like, it's funny because.
He's a jerk. Can I just say that? He's a jerk.
No, exactly. There. And the Toronto FC guy, Mo.
Mo Johnson.
Yeah.
He was a jerk.
Was,
no, don't know if he was a jerk. I think he was a bit of a con man.
Oh, but I'm not sure he was a jerk. You know what he was? He was the epitome of, if any of us went to run a hockey team in Scotland, we would get diplomatic immunity for 5 years. So he could bring over, you know, like Joe Schmo and talk about, yeah, I knew him when he was at Aberdeen or whatever. And for a few years, everybody bought into it that way. And so it's funny when you think of characters and ones that have been, you know, whether it's Masai right now with the Toronto Raptors or you look at Brendan Shanahan with the Toronto Maple Leafs. I mean, guys that have had some vision and that versus others that you look back at. And Kevin O'Neill is a great example.
Yep.
You say, was he really a coach for a while?
Exactly. And I mean, he came in on like highly recommended and he was sort of a hot thing at the time. And just, and I think that the issue with Kevin O'Neill is in some aspects of basketball, he was, a very good technical coach. People would attest to that. But in other areas of being a human being, he fell well short.
So since we're doing kind of a reflective show, Stephen, when you look back at people and you say, I really can't believe, like John Heward, the Argo coach, that was the most bizarre.
Yeah, he was a very strange guy.
No, but from the introductory press conference from the word go, like you kind of say, I can't believe these guys were actually involved with a professional sports team. And because I'm here, leave me out if I happen to be a candidate.
Yeah, he was fascinating. He was a fascinating guy. He was a brilliant guy in his own way. Like he was, you know, he was, and he'd written these books and,
which he told you about, and they were unpublished, by the way.
They were unpublished, but he was quite complete. I'll tell you something though. I remember he came up here and he started using tight ends, and no one had used the tight end in the CFL in 25 years. And everybody laughed at him. Said, what are you doing? You know, like, you can't do this. You're running a 25-year-old offense. Teams use those guys. Then they started using them. Like, he was actually a little ahead of the curve. You know, he's behind the curve or ahead of the curve, but he was, you know, the curve was moving back in his direction anyway. But that was, yeah, that was J.I. Albrecht running the team, who is one of the great characters that I've ever encountered in sport. He would be on that list. Yeah. You know what? I'll tell you, though. We were talking about the Argos in those days. We're not talking about them. Well, we're talking about them today. But they were kind of in the news, and people cared one way or another who was coaching the team. So that's a little different than it is now.
They were owned by the New York-based insurance mogul.
Sherwood Schwartz. I think that was Sherwood Schwartz at that point.
Yeah, he was the buddies of J.I.
You know, and they did the and they brought in Garth Rubinsky, remember, to do, like, again, where...
Well, I remember the only time I've been in the same room as Muhammad Ali was some scheme.
He was there for the Argos, the promotion for the Argos.
I still remember him.
That was Garth. They brought him in.
How is that possible?
Well, you know, till 2015, from the time Joe Carter hit the walk-off home run till the Jays were in the playoffs, the only compelling September baseball was the 1 year Tim Johnson was a manager.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, but there's a strange one.
They won the 188 games that year, so they were actually, it was a good team.
Yeah, but I mean, the one guy who actually had a great, you know, great background as a AAA manager, but obviously too many other things going on. I mean, he was here for one meteoric year, but it actually was a team that had a lot of pop on the field.
Until he... What was his motivational technique that
it all came because Roger Clemens skipped a start in Boston. He didn't want to start. So whoever the pitcher was, maybe it was Henkin. And so he explained why you need to do it for the team. And then he fabricated those military stories in there, which got him in the end.
Yes. I think Dave Perkins was the,
you may be correct about
was
that,
the person
yes.
who shone some light on that.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's funny. I mean, it's funny, Gord, when you talk about it, and you were sort of front and center for maybe the gold standard of Toronto sports fiascos in terms of the Ballard era. Although it's hard to pick exactly.
I love the idea of the gold standard fiasco. By the way, gold plated fiasco, right?
I used to be the guy, because I'm still around. And I got a good memory and in the media. So it's mostly positive for the Leafs right now. We are going to talk about it more, but if something negative happened, I would be the research guy. So media people would phone me about, hey, has it this thing of infamy happened? Can you remember whatever? And usually I could come up with a pretty good comparable that way as far as it went. So I mean, some interesting times. And actually, I said, as far as primetime sports went, the first time I was on this show was as general manager of the Leafs with Bob McCown and Bill Waters. So, you know, got going. So I kind of was on the other side before I got on this side. And when I came on, there was a lot, we were off to a good start. There was a briefly good start. There was a lot of optimism going on. And kind of like a Leaf team this year, much more well-rounded team, looking for a good start, a good middle, and a good finish. And what do you make of the Toronto Maple Leafs 2019-2020 so far?
Well, too early to be anything other than... Well, I'll say this. It's... They generate and have generated legitimate excitement. Like, there's no question that around the circles, you know, you move around and the anticipation, and I think it maybe was in some ways a carryover from the Raptors, you know, what they did all through June and all that. So there was just a massive anticipation, and of course they, you know, they come out pretty strong early. But, you know, to draw any conclusions after, you know, what they've done the past two games is probably premature, but other than, you know, I don't think they're going undefeated. In fact, we know that now. And, to me, they're like one of the great experiments, right? It is, you know, they're in a hard cap league. There's only so many different ways to build a team. And, you know, the tendency is to kind of have, you know, be a bit Goldilocks, right? A little bit of this, a little bit of that, not too hot, not too cold. And Kyle Dubas or Shanahan or whoever's, you know, vision this is said, you know what? We're going to go all in on being this type of team. And that's how we're going to apportion our money. And we'll create great advantages in this area. By necessity, you'll kind of have some shortcomings in other areas because you only have this much money. And we'll see if it works.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like the conversation, you're right about the excitement. But it goes back, I think, to the Tavares signing, which is kind of that kind of the die is cast at that point, right? This is the way, number one, that they actually get him, convince him to come to Toronto. Yeah. They've gone, you know, the whole thing with Stamkos and it turns him down. They actually get Tavares to come. He wants to be here. And I think, you know, this storyline kind of begins there. I'm not sure where it's going to end. But the, you know, in terms of the kind of team you are going to build and where you're going to have to spend your money, you know, that's, it's, you know, unless you're going to let guys, you're going to give up on the signing the Nylanders and the Mariners of the world. Everybody kind of knew at that point, well, this is where your money's going to go. You're going to dump a ton of money on your top six guys. And, you know, can you, as you say, that, you know, can you win that way? Number one, can you win with a payroll structure like they have? And two, can you win playing the kind of style they're going to play?
Right.
And it's, you know, and again, that's whatever happens in October, the only answers available are going to become in the spring. You know, like first step, let's win a playoff series first. Let's see him win a playoff series. But, no, like, you've got a pretty active debate in hockey circles right now of whether a team like this, no matter how talented they are in the top six, whether they can win.
And of course, you cover basketball quite extensively. And what I'm finding to model a bit after is there's no debate this year about signing Nylander, signing Matthews, signing Marner. Like, imagine going in this season with a repeat of, you know, the Nylander thing with Marner. So I think what we're seeing is the Raptors had to do it in 1 year with Kawhi Leonard, basically. Now you've established that it's 5 years. You've got Nylander and Matthews for 5 years. You've got Marner, Tavares for 6 years. You don't have to worry about Freddie Anderson for 2 years. You don't have to worry about Morgan Riley for 3 years. So it's almost, I think, you know, despite all the things, okay, can they sign, keep Tyson Barry? I mean, those are all year to year. Kyle's going to have to be creative on that thing. But you've got your linchpins, and you don't have the 1 year ticking time clock. You got five.
Right. And with the exception of Tavares, they're young. Right.
Yeah.
So you're going to get their best years.
But you see it that way? Like once you got him in the mold, you got
yeah.
With those guys, you got 5 years.
Yeah, you do. But I think you have this year, you know, because you're going to have to deal with your defensively with Muzzin gone and Barry gone, right? After this year.
Well,
right?
You're probably able to keep one of them.
Yeah, maybe. And you also need some of your young guys to pan out, you know, mm-hmm. and play cheap for the first on their entry level deals. So some stuff's got to happen. I just wonder though, Gord, like if they get to the playoffs this year and get rolled in the first round, and don't, you know, you take your whatever adjective you want to use, that they're not gritty enough or tough enough or heavy enough or whatever those things you have to be in the playoffs. All the things that St. Louis definitely was last year, won a Stanley Cup. But if somebody, you know, kind of rolls them in the first round, what are the next 3 years? You know, that's
the only thing about it is, you know, this. If you want to call it experiment or path that they've chosen, it's kind of coincided with, you know, some kind of weird background circumstances, you know, one of them being the NHL's playoff structure, which I've never heard anyone really defend, right? The idea that you...
some do. I don't like it, but
you're not really good,
but you're right.
Right, but when it comes to playoff time within your conference, you're not getting...
Yeah.
You're not creating an optimum opportunity for the best teams to advance.
Yeah.
That, you know, so that they've kind of run into that. And at the same time, as you've got two teams in their division, Tampa and Boston, who, you know, like they probably had three of the top five teams in their division, in hockey, in their division. And so it's a little bit akin, and again, it's a stretch, to, you know, people saying the Houston Rockets are a failed experiment because they haven't won an NBA title. Well, yeah, but the only team they couldn't beat was the Golden State Warriors, and they should have at least twice.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't – I personally – or if you go back a step further, you know, when Steve Nash and Mike D'Antoni were with the Phoenix Suns and said, well, they can't win playing basketball that way. Well, it turned out you could, and it's been shown without doubt. So I think if – and it's possible, right? They could go through this year, have another good year like they did last year, and run into Boston or Tampa in the first round and lose in seven games and – you know, and I just don't know if that draws enough conclusions.
But that's the Washington Capitol model in that, you know, right. St. Louis, no question. They burst through and all of a sudden, like Los Angeles Kings did, kind of won it at their first crack at it, where the Washington Capitol showed that you know, it's easy to tear it down. People were pissed. They could have done it quite easily. They stayed the course. And almost when you least expected it,
yeah,
they got all the way through. So, I mean, I think Toronto with now.
That was a tough, nasty Washington team, you know, with a crazy great skill guy.
Oh, yeah, but in 2010, yeah, they didn't have Tom Wilson.
That's right.
I'm just saying they didn't have goaltending.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, so you've got a morph and figure, but you got Ovechkin and you got Backstrom, like you've got Matthews and you've got Marner. And no question. I mean, there's other things. It's not, and those things weren't just money either, you know, and the kind of guys they got.
I think. What's a little bit interesting with the Leafs is, I mean, clearly the model in the salary cap era is you have to invest heavily in your top six players or your top. Generally, it's, you know, been some combination of forwards and defensemen that you know that's your core, your best six guys, and really I think what's a little bit different about the Leafs is four of those top five guys are forwards. Right, so
yeah,
they don't. I mean, Riley's kind of emerged as a close to legit number one. I think
absolutely
most would agree. But what's different, and I think where there's stuff yet to be proven is how you build your bottom six and your bottom pair D, and it's typically those. Okay, well now we'll bring in the monsters, right, and we'll win on our power play and we'll grind you to dust the rest of the time. And they haven't done that. The Leafs fourth line the last 2 years has been as fast and as skilled as a lot of teams second line. And, you know, and they're, who's there in their bottom pair D, like a 19-year-old Swedish defenseman. He's not,
well, at least
anybody.
There's some optimism. So, Rasmus Sandin Dermott when he's healthy.
Yeah, have looked they're the same kind of player, which isn't say a bad player. They're up-tempo, their speed, their skill. They're not, you know, nobody's scared of, is there anyone on the Leafs that scares anyone in any kind of net front or corner situation?
No, and that's a philosophical decision.
That's a choice they've made.
They've made made that choice.
And it's, that's fine. We're not going to take penalties. We'll meet you on the power play, and we'll exhibit our toughness by still being willing to go in those areas, even though we're the ones typically taking the punishment. And that's the test, right? That seems to work pretty well in the regular season. We'll find out if it works.
Well, there's this debate in the playoffs, and it's about...
And really, the number one variable in that is going to be how games are refereed. If they're refereed as they are in the regular season, then the Leafs probably have a good chance. If they're not, they're screwed.
And, you know, with Nazem Kadri's exit, I think a lot of people look at, oh, my God, look what he had to do. Well, he didn't really have to. You know, the first year he went after a guy that hit Mitch Marner. Mitch Marner was fine. Second, same thing. Like, the whole thing about heavy hockey, and I agree, the Blues did a great job finishing checks, doing all those things. Heavy hockey can be Patrick Kane just exhausting the crap out of you for seven games or five games, or Sidney Crosby. I mean, there's a lot of components about it where heavy hockey used to be the physicality, the Broad Street Bullies, the Big Bad Bruins, and all that to a bit of an extent. And then, but the last little while, you know, getting Matt Martin wasn't the solution for a guy who all of a sudden found the other guys in the fourth line were too fast.
Yeah, you know, you got to be able to play and you got to be able to skate. But Berkey and I've talked about this a lot. You know, he'll talk about that Anaheim team, and that was, you know, he said we fought in the first round and we fought in the finals and we fought in the two rounds in between. That's not happening anymore. That's, you don't, and it's not about the fighting part.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's an interesting experiment to try and get through to go all in this way. You know, and again, aesthetically, it's awesome, man. I want to watch these guys play. But whether you can get through that four-round grind in the spring.
When you haven't got through one.
You haven't got through one, you're going to have crazy good goaltending. Now, you have to have great goaltending to win the Stanley Cup anyway, but you're going to have great goaltending. And I don't know. You know, I'm not super old school. But when I hear Cherry say they're not tough enough, he might be right.
Yeah, you know? Well, I think it's easier to mess up pretty offense than it is to create it, right?
Negating something is always in there.
Yeah, so it really comes down to how it's going to be refereed. And then I guess there is an element of it is hockey and you can scare guys, right? Because it's dangerous. Yeah.
But
and
it's a legitimate observation. There's no question. Like it is. But it's not like the Maple Leafs are caught by surprise. Like someone wrote about, Kyle Dubas has basically doubled down on this style of hockey.
Right. No, that's absolutely right.
You put $40 million of these guys and then you have whatever left, another $40 million to spend, and you go, okay, I'm going to keep spending it on guys who can keep up with my expensive guys.
Yeah. Well, Jim Ralph was saying, of course, the color voice on our network and that, Leaf Games. So he was one of the MCs for the Jamie Daniels Foundation dinner in Detroit, Ken Daniels dinner that he started on behalf of his late son. They roasted Mickey Redmond. And, of course, Ralphie's great at that. So he said he told Mike Babcock before. So he gave Mike Babcock a line. So when Mike Babcock spoke, one of his lines was, and Jim Ralph's here, who's great at impersonating everything except a goaltender, right? So he gave him that line. And then when Ralphie talked about it, he just said, Mike Babcock, he's so dedicated to this this charity and this event that afterwards he's going to stay around. He's going to stay around. He's going to buy everybody a drink because, as everyone knows in Toronto, he's good for one round. That was what he said. So the point being is Mike Babcock knows that. Everybody else knows that, you know, whether it's Sheldon Keefe with the Toronto Marlies, as Kyle Dubas' guy, he will be the sacrificial lamb for better, for worse, the short-term measure if they don't at least advance to the second round.
Well, and the question is, I mean, as he's coming off two tough losses to very good teams, is, you know, the kind of weak spot in the web here is, you know, Kyle Dubas, with, I presume, the blessing of Brendan Shanahan, has chosen a path and a style. So the question is, and it bubbles up whenever, you know, Mike Babcock kind of sends his very transparent messages at his press conferences, is, has Mike Babcock completely bought in to the path that Kyle Dubas has sent him down?
Well, it's not that different than his teams played in Detroit, right? Those are not tough, heavy teams in Detroit.
Yeah. Not in the sense of... You know, they're going to terrify you.
No, they never fought. And, you know, he was successful there. Now he had a lot of talent. I don't think they're
I agree with that. I totally agree with that. But I do wonder if there's, you know, if Babcock, like all coaches do, at some point look down their bench and go, I don't have enough of this. What am I doing with these guys? And I don't think he's shy about saying it. And
kind of a passive-aggressive way.
Yeah, right. Well, the end of season, I've mentioned this many times, the post-game press conference, the coach first, and then the general manager a day or two after. And first of all, it always annoys me when someone says, two more questions, and you go, he's got all summer. You know, we're not getting really answers figuring about Austin Matthews ice time and whatever. But I watched those two and listened to those two, and I thought, did these guys work with the same team? Like, just there, you know, so in a lot of ways, I think it threw a lot of crap out there, and it just established that, yes, it's Kyle Dubas' team, and Mike Babcock will be the guy held accountable this season. That everything got out there that Babcock during the season would allude to, yeah, we got some injuries, but the guys we call up aren't, you know, they're not quite as good as guys on other teams, you know, and that's not a shot at Kyle. Well, it is, you know, so I think in a lot of ways, everyone signed, they needed to, the cards are on the table. The 82-game season isn't totally irrelevant unless something dire happens, but otherwise, it's the playoffs are bust and Mike Babcock are bust.
Yeah, no, I would think that would be the next step, right? You know, if this doesn't pan out, but all answers come in the spring. I don't think we're going to get any answers until then.
Well, it'll be in Detroit tomorrow night. Of course, we'll have the Leafs Nation postgame. We had Nick Alberg on earlier. Myself and Nick will be on. We'll find out Mike Babcock in his old stomping ground. When we come back, we will continue with more of the Friday Night Roundtable. Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt, Mike Grange, and Elliot Friedman, all on the Sportsnet Radio Network and on Sportsnet 360.
Subscribe to the Hockey Central podcast with your favorite podcatcher, Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now back to Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Welcome back to Friday Primetime Sports Roundtable. Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt, Michael Grange, and the imminent arriving Elliot Friedman will be joining us on the last Friday Roundtable on Primetime Sports. Want to remind everybody, you can win the weekly $500 prize pack and qualify for our grand prize Toronto Sports Weekend Getaway with the VTech Wake Up Call Contest. Give us a call at 416-413-4141. Leave us your best Toronto sports take. And starting next week, set your alarms to 8:20 a.m. every Friday morning for the VTech Wake Up Call on the leadoff with Ashley, Ziggy, and Scotty Mack. Visit sportsnet.ca/590 for details. So we'll do a little potpourri because we're going to save some stuff for Elliot when he gets in, fighting the traffic. And a curiosity question I have for you, Michael, and I guess Stephen, but just because you cover the basketball so much, and Mike Babcock and load management, the whole load management situation. And with, it seems like Freddie Anderson is the target, that there's people following him, and when he yawns, they'll text each other and say he needs a game off or something. My point being is, I understand Kawhi Leonard was a very unique situation, a very successful, the way it played out and the plan they had in place. What other things were different with the other Toronto Raptor players? I mean, are we talking about Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner, like missing games for load management? Like you go to a Leaf game and theoretically you pay all that money for a ticket and a 22-year-old guy is missing a game because of load management? I mean, I just mean the other applications beyond Kawhi Leonard.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of things have been conflated when or, you know, kind of mixed in when people talk about load management. I mean, no one... I shouldn't say. I mean, but when you know, when a major league pitcher is coming off Tommy John surgery, or when you know they're kind of introducing a new starter to the major leagues, and you know there's an awareness of how many innings they should be pitching, how many pitches they should be throwing in between rests, you know, and more they're getting more kind of cognizant of.
It's really called sports science, though. Isn't that the bigger thing?
Yeah, that's the bigger thing.
But management's part of it.
But I mean,
yeah.
I'm saying in baseball, we're so used to it and no one questions it. And
yeah.
Kawhi Leonard...
Catchers don't catch a day game
right.
after a night game.
Yeah. Sure. And Kawhi Leonard in particular, he was the equivalent of a pitcher coming off Tommy John surgery. Mm-hmm. Not exactly, but similar.
Sure.
In other words, he had a very specific problem and there was a way it needed to be managed and it was, you know, unwise to try and rush him back just because convention said, well, you're healthy, you're going to play all 82.
No question.
But it didn't really translate into any other Raptors.
Well, that's what
it, right? Like Kyle Lowry, I think, played, I mean, he got hurt, but he was on pace to play a lot of games. And then if you look around the league, there were, you know, a handful of other teams and would kind of manage a handful of their players in such a way to that they would avoid the kind of the red flag points in a schedule. So, you know, second night of back-to-back, third game in four nights, on the road in a different time zone. More and more teams have wisely looked at that because they have data now. They yeah. can look like this is A, when teams people get hurt, and B, even when you're healthy, you're probably not winning that game anyway.
Well, the value of rest and recovery, right? Because that's a huge part of what sports science
right.
has and become, right?
Exactly, and especially the rest and recovery. And it, but it's not a case of 82 games. Well, it's not like people are going to play 55, right? Like it's, you know, 82, barring any other injuries, illnesses, maybe 74, 73. It's like a couple of days off here and there. It's being able, you know, if we sit him out this night, then he gets four full days off. Let's try that.
Other Raptor players would sit out games when they were healthy?
It's happened in the past, and typically it would kind of come towards the end of the year, because in the NBA, you know, a lot of times your playoff seeding is pretty much fixed by a certain
right.
point of the year, so there's nothing, you know, there's nothing to lose. And in hockey, I mean, with goaltending, like, there's data. Like, they know exactly that goaltenders playing, it's the second night and back-to-backs aren't as good. Doesn't matter who the goalie is. So let's avoid these situations and let's preserve our goalie to make sure they're playing fresh. So I don't think that's crazy. And on the bigger picture, to making sure that in the NHL your best players aren't playing at times of peak fatigue, I'm stunned it hasn't happened yet. Yeah. I am stunned. There's two things that blow me away in hockey. One is the second night of back-to-backs doesn't always seem to affect hockey teams as much.
Basketball, it's huge.
Basketball, it's incredible. Yeah. But in hockey, I'm always kind of amazed.
You can roll four lines. There's ways to do it.
I guess that's what it is.
If you got a four-line team and you're confident, a back-to-back, you should be rolling four lines.
Right. But, I mean, they've done it in hockey. There's a lot less morning skates now, right? Guys sleep.
Sure. I respect the sports science part about it.
But I'm also, to me, Patrick Marleau last year, why did that guy – that's a complete error on terms of management and coaching that guy played every game.
Well, he's got the street coin, right? That's the problem.
Too bad. Yeah. We're paying you $6 million bucks.
I know. It's done.
Because I bet you he would have been a lot better hockey player for them had he played 60 games instead of 80.
Yeah.
And similarly, with the depth of a lineup in the NHL and the depth of scoring the Leafs have, I would think they'd be wise to look for opportunities to kind of sequentially rest their key guys. And I don't think it's all that new. I've heard stories that Scotty Bowman would send each of his big three defensemen to Florida for a week, in the second half of the season.
I don't remember.
Get ready for the playoffs.
Anyway.
But it does the idea that because you can work out constantly now, right? You can work. You can, there's no off. But that idea that they're forcing players to stop, right? Giving them opportunities, that idea of kind of the regeneration time.
Right.
And that's become very,
And I think the biggest one is that you're not shamed for it.
Yeah. And the other thing is, Mike, all games are not created equally, right? Like 100%. Regular season is what it is, right? But, in the National Hockey League, if you're going to play four brutal rounds to win the Stanley Cup after you've played your season, probably be smart to try and keep some bullets back for that. If you can, to think it through. The thing with Kawhi last year, yeah, it was like he was coming back off Tommy John. It's exactly what it was like. But it was also, you understood what the goal was.
Right. But I think the point Gord's making is once you kind of, it's like a lot of things, like once you pull the curtain back a little bit or start peeling the onion or whatever analogy you want to use, and you kind of expose the fact that, yeah, guess what? Tuesday night in Milwaukee.
Doesn't matter that much.
Thursday night at home against Florida, whatever, pick your opponent.
Oh, how about holiday Monday in Toronto for a baseball team?
Right. But you know what I mean? So once you start kind of exposing that, then it becomes a challenge for your sales force to still expect that people are going to pay for games that you've deemed not as important.
Yeah, there's the marketing question versus the kind of world of forms thing, right? If you're doing this without fans, then you wouldn't have to worry about that at all.
But there was a badge used to be about being on the ice all the time, and I totally agree.
And it was a big thing in the NBA too.
And you didn't need to be.
A big thing.
I mean, it was a badge coaches did that. I don't care what time we get in, we're going to practice. Sometimes morning skates.
It's because they didn't know, though.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And you know the morning skate, how it started? You know why it's called a morning skate? Because in the original six era, your skates were hit and miss. There weren't a lot of guys that were great at sharpening skates. Right. So part of it was you're responsible to test it out in the morning and find out and then bring it to the attention. I guess the Leafs had a guy named Tommy Naylor who apparently was a legend. Mm-hmm. So George Armstrong, God love him, his thing was, the rule was your skates had to touch the ice. So he would wait till the end and he'd be in a suit because you had to wear a suit and he would just put his skates on and wouldn't tie them up. And would go out one door and shimmy along and come in the other door, and that would basically meet the guideline about it. And then it morphed into a full fledged practice. And you mentioned, God rest his soul, John Brophy. We saw morning skates that the guys had no chance of playing a game after that. So, right.
But I mean, I think in some ways the other is true as well, in that rest and recovery are obviously huge performance indicators, but I do, and maybe it's an old school thing to say, I do think there is an element of, there's a mental toughness of guys who are able to push through the slog. And to create a sort of system of internal priorities where they make themselves ready more often than not. And I'm not saying that's going to go the other way, but I don't think it's irrelevant that you know, a badge of honor in the big, all the major pro sports is to show up, is to play 82 or close to it, and carry your load. And that to me is not to be, I don't think it should be dismissed, because it speaks to, you know, a kind of a mental toughness and a commitment that I think is useful when you're trying to build championship
teams. I think those guys are going to get forced to sit down.
Sure. But that's, you know.
So you're saying, okay, Kawhi Leonard, we know, like it'd be if Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner were coming back from a significant knee injury, there'd be an understanding. But as I say, whatever the price or tickets are for a home game and you go, and, you know, I'd still have a hard time getting my head around scratches for tonight's game, either Mitch Marner or Austin Matthews, due to load management.
Yeah, but you probably wouldn't do both. You'd probably do...
No, I mean, even one of them. I don't care. Yeah. The home. Like, so, okay, so should you pick on the road? Should you pick against a team for the conference?
If we're really talking about sports science, and I can't speak for how the Leafs do it, but I would know, as the Raptors do it, is they monitor their players' vital signs, right? Yeah. Like, they have data tracking, you know, their heart rate recovery, their resting heart rate in the morning, their... you know, in some cases it goes as deep into blood work and things like that. Where are they short in their mineralization? And I've seen NBA teams where they have, you know, instead of having like a row of recovery drinks, they have like a row of, it's almost like liquid vitamins that are individually kind of assigned to each guy, because that's what they particularly need.
Same thing happened in baseball. Baseball's doing the same
thing. Same in broadcasting. Our load management was Elliot Friedman has been working a lot. So we said, you know, he is going to come in for the second half of the first hour. And joining us, Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt, Michael Grange, Elliot Friedman. And we are going to reminisce later on about the whole primetime sports and the roundtable, since this is the last show. But we're talking, my question I was saying before you came in, it's interesting because you've got your basketball background and now the
which
hockey
guy.
Which I
like to remind people of from time.
Yes. Well, no, but about like load management now, when they're talking about it in Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment with the Kawhi Leonard situation and how it was managed, are you getting to the point that, because I trust they carry a lot of clout, but they'll be saying Mitch Marner or Austin Matthews have to miss actual games, not because of injury, but because of load management. I can accept skates not happening, days off, all those other things. Are we getting there?
Anaheim talked about it 2 years ago with Ryan Getzlaf. They talked to him in the offseason about how would you feel about taking a certain amount of games off a year. And ultimately, they decided not to do it. I mean, one of the biggest differences between the NBA and the NHL is that in the NBA, it's a top-heavy league, right? The Raptors knew last year they were making the playoffs. They could take chances with Kawhi Leonard and say, even if he misses, what was it, 22 games? Yeah. They were reasonably content they were going to be a playoff team. I think the NHL teams are too scared of it. I think they feel the margin of victory and defeat is so slim, the race for the playoffs is so tight, that until the end of the season, Gordy, I think these teams are afraid of the idea. I don't think it's coming here yet.
Well, we want to save hockey talk for you at the top of the hour. So we're going to move from load management and load managed baseball talk right now. I know that's not the smoothest of segues, but I got to say, when I was getting set to watch the Wednesday night hockey. And I said, great, I can catch the Atlanta St. Louis game. And then I can catch the back end of the Washington Dodger game. And I turned on the ugliest first inning I've ever seen. It was so surreal, including that, as someone called it, the saddest 10th run in an inning ever, when the missed third strike, that the batter started to go to the bench and the team yelled at him and the catcher McCann fell and whatever, and then turned it on late at night for the incredible comeback by the Washington Nationals. So I guess it goes back to, that's why you play all the games as we head into down to the Final Four.
The best was, sorry, Steven, someone sent me a story about people who didn't get to the game until after the first inning was over, and they basically turned right around and left. That was awesome.
Well, it's, you know, they scored 10 runs without a home run, and they gave up, and they gave up the first out on a sack bunt. They're playing for one. Like, that's, you know, like there's a bunch of things. The first time in postseason history anybody's ever scored 10 runs in the first inning, but they you know, they were playing small ball and still scored 10. You know, like, I'm happy that the chanting folks in Atlanta, you know, who made their big stand that night because they didn't get their rubber tomahawks given out. So they made the chant was doubly loud that night. I thought there was some justice in the fact that they got smoked in the first inning. But, Yeah, an amazing day of baseball. Like, that game was bizarre. You know, literally, that's never happened before in the entire postseason history of baseball. And then, you know, yeah, the kind of the high drama of that Dodgers-Nationals thing, which it's hard not to feel awful for Clayton Kershaw. You know, he's a Hall of Fame pitcher. He's one of the best pitchers any of us will ever see.
Mm-hmm.
And to watch, you know, him fail as spectacularly. He's not, you know, the first home run wasn't as terrible a pitch. The second one was an awful pitch. But, you know, we're used to seeing guys thrive, you know, kind of great athletes thrive under pressure routinely. It's just part of the deal, right? You get big stage. They all want to be on the big stage. And he was on the big stage. They're in a position to close that game out, essentially, and failed spectacularly. We're not, you know, it's harder to process that than a guy rising to the occasion. It really is.
Now, are they overthinking the pitching? I mean, Dusty Baker did it in Washington before. That's one reason they never gone this far. And again, who are we to critique managers? But it just seems, whether you go back to Steve Rogers all those years ago coming in the ninth inning, that they do things they wouldn't do during the regular season, which to a degree is understandable. But has it not backfired more often than not?
You know, actually, you know, if you look at Kershaw's last four really
he came in last
that.
Year and
he was
won
good
one.
Yeah, he yeah. was good. Yeah, so it's not it's
what have you done for me lately?
But baseball play, you put your best guy. The postseason is different, you know, and it is different for a reason. But yeah, you do usually throw your best guy out there. You know, there's questions about, you know, whether he should have gone to another one of his best guys, gone to Maeda at that stage, or, you know, do you
left
go
the other guy in for Kelly?
Go
for
in the second inning
long.
With Joe Kelly, you know, yeah. But you don't know what. They, you know, Kenley Jansen. You know, the other point that's got to be, you know, somebody made it this week, and it's a good one, which is the way baseball teams work now. You know, Dave Roberts is getting hung out for those decisions. That's not how baseball decisions are made.
No.
Anymore. You know, that whole organization was in on those decisions. Those decisions were made before that game happened about who was going to come in when in certain situations. It's, you know, managing is not, no one's doing it by the seat of their pants anymore.
I have to tell you, that has been the most interesting thing for me about reading the coverage after, because, you know, I love baseball. I have more trouble watching baseball now than ever, aside from the postseason, because it's the most scripted sport around. You know, it's all planned out. The managers almost have no say anymore. Like, they are told this is how your decisions are going to work, and this is how they're not going to work. And I read an article and saying this is why Dave Roberts screwed up this game, and I saw someone reporting, I can't believe that Dave Roberts is going to be asked back to manage the Dodgers. And my reaction to that was, why is it on him? Like, unless he varied from the script that they told him to do, why is he the guy who's getting ripped for all of this?
Like, I think when Buck Showalter left, it was Zach Britton, right, on the bench,
yep.
You know, and that, in that game in Toronto, and Encarnacion hit the home run to win the wild card. I think that was Buck Showalter. Mm-hmm. I think that was actually Buck Showalter making that decision, holding his closer for a situation, which is a terrible idea in that kind of game. But I think that was him. But when I think what I'm thinking about is what that Orioles organization is like and what Showalter is like versus what the Andrew Friedman Dodgers are like. And
yes.
I, you know, and again, but you know, the flip side of that, Elliot, is, you know, you watched the Rays beat Justin Verlander with a bullpen game. You know,
I know,
which was the most incredible mix and match I've ever seen.
I was going to win my bet, and yes. Then I forgot Garrett Cole was going in game five. I'm like, I'm not winning this bet.
But, you know, to see the decisions made in that game, and again, a lot of that stuff, Lord knows they are analytically driven, but I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure one person alone could have kind of scripted that game out with that pitching the way they did mm-hmm. to beat the Astros. That was astounding to watch. You know, like, there's been a lot of really interesting stuff happening in this, and some of it is this very new school, you know, approach to the game, and maybe it backfires occasionally, but
playoffs are still great.
A lot of knowledge out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, but the playoffs are still great, but I think of Pat Gillick's excellent Seattle team that got eliminated in a 3 out of 5, right? And so here we have a Dodger team that's kind of like a Tampa Bay Lightning team. Should they not be 4 out of 7s? Like, they always say the season, they'll see, like, you play 162 games. Like, how can you argue
there's
about...
There still are 2 4 out of 7.
Yeah.
Yeah, no,
yeah,
but... Yeah.
But, I mean, you're still... Only you got to get there. Right?
Well, I know, but should it be a 3 out of 5 anymore?
You sound like those Jays fans still bitching about 1985.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah,
well,
I would say this:
yes.
Would baseball not be served better as well served if you cut the regular season down by a week and you did play 3 7-game series?
It's probably where it's going. You know,
right?
Again,
because,
for commercial,
yeah.
Like the traditional number was 154, wasn't
right.
160.
Way, way back.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
and you know,
you argue that
and when it was right, there was just the two leagues. And they've, you know, you played 154 to determine two winners. And
one best of seven.
And those two teams played in the World Series. Whereas now you've kind of broadened the field and you do introduce this element of chance. And it goes back to what we were talking about, you know, with load management, is you run the risk of cheapening your regular season to the point it doesn't matter. So you have the Los Angeles Dodgers, an organization that's done everything right and spent, you know, earth loads of money and were rewarded in terms of a fantastic regular season, and they're at home because of a five-game playoff series, which in five games in baseball is nothing. So I think that that's a good point.
It is. I think it's going to happen not for that reason, but for because postseason, you know, content
makes
has more
money.
Value. Yeah, absolutely. But you know, they don't want to play baseball in November. You mm-hmm. know, that's part of it. They have been forced into that, but they don't want to do that. But yeah, I think you're going to see. When baseball expands by two teams, you're going to probably see a complete realignment of baseball that's going to be more, you know, conferences and divisions in a kind of a same kind of schematic as the National Football League has, and you're going to see an expanded playoff. But that's for money reasons. You know, everybody wants more playoffs, more playoff inventory. You know, the reason they added the wild card is they wanted more meaningful games in September, more teams in pennant races, therefore more people watching, more people in the stands. The next iteration of that has got to be expanded playoffs. You know, I think it's going to come, you know, and I don't know what it'll feel like, you know, because the one thing that's different about baseball is that you play this incredibly, insanely long season, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really hard to get in. It's really hard to
even
make
now.
The playoffs. Yeah.
But you know what, Steven, you were there. Is there anything worse in sports media than covering a baseball team that's out of it in July?
Oh, it's tough.
Is there anything worse
than that? I
worked
in the
press
box for the Jays the first 4 years of their existence, from 1977 to 1980.
So you left and the team got good?
That was basically, yeah.
Where'd you go after that, Gord?
It was, Canfax Communications. I sent all the paper copy. But it just was, even just in a lesser role, being there. Like, and then when the team would go on the road, you'd miss them. And then they were back. You were sick of them after two games, yeah. Right? You know, just whatever. And then when they got starting in 83, you don't have to win it all. I can remember Pat Henkin saying the line there, or Tom Henke, when he came over, whatever number of years, there was never not a game that didn't matter. Mm-hmm. Like, all of a sudden, every game mattered because you're always in the hunt. And then when you're right, when you're out of it, man, you're out of it.
But, I mean, that's sort of like how we've changed how we come to view baseball anyway, maybe a lot of sports though, is it used to be, yeah, okay, your team sucked, but baseball, it was still, okay, every fifth day you might have a really interesting young starter and we'll watch him. And then, you know, no matter how bad their team, there's always somebody who's putting together a pretty good year and all these kinds of stuff. And again, going back to the roots of the game, it's always been this way, mm-hmm. right? There's always been like, you know, two, three teams competing for whatever.
They're always the
it's
Yankees.
It's a ratio,
they're
right?
always the Yankees.
Always the Yankees.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think this notion that every single game should all be equally entertaining is probably, you know, fanciful, right? Because it's never always been that way.
It doesn't make sense anymore.
Yes.
Playoff sells. And if I was every sport, I'd be getting I don't care about people who say, oh, you water down the regular season or everybody gets in, everybody gets a trophy. To me, that's all BS. What the playoffs sell and the races sell. And if I was every league, I'd be trying to do whatever I could to make sure more teams were still in it and a few more teams got in because that's what people want to watch.
The model.
And that's what the sponsors pay for.
How about the model being the Toronto Raptors? Like, how many people that like the Raptors probably didn't watch a full regular season game, in all seriousness, you know, and then were on a ride about the playoffs that just elevated, escalated, and escalated?
Yep.
Like, it's the perfect model of what you're talking about. Mm.
I remember last year, Kelly.
Once every 25 years, guaranteed. Yeah.
Not guaranteed. Year,
Kelly Rudy and Jim Houston and Craig Simpson, one from Calgary, one from Vancouver, one from Edmonton, coming to the Stanley Cup final and saying they knew people who didn't watch the Raptors ever, who were glued to their televisions. That was, I don't know what else is going to happen in Canada in 2019. I hear we're going to elect another prime minister potentially.
Or maybe the same guy.
Or maybe the same guy, but nothing in this country will be bigger than that was in 2019. Mm. Not even the election. Not even close.
Well, we will come back and we'll talk about whether it's the baseball, but certainly the hockey front, now that we have Elliot here to find out. Maybe there's a great Canadian story in 2020 as far as going through the Stanley Cup playoffs go. We're also going to chat a little basketball and talk about something that we didn't talk a whole lot, but maybe very apropos the final primetime roundtable, because so many people with football lineage like Jim Shakey Hunt and that would love to hear us talk about the beloved Toronto Argonauts and Canadian Football League, with Pinball Clemens being hired earlier this week by the Argos. We'll address all those topics the next hour of the Friday Roundtable on Primetime Sports. Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt, Michael Grange, Elliot Friedman on the Friday Roundtable. You're listening to Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network and watching on Sportsnet 360.
Subscribe to the Scoreboard Podcast with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Utah sad like a pile of leaves. I've got to find some better weeds. 4-5 meter run around the bend when the government needs to surround you again. If dying young won't change your mind. Baby, 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 right now.
Welcome back. Primetime Sports, the Friday Roundtable. Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt, Michael Grange, Elliot Friedman. As one more hour, and we mentioned we'll sort of reminisce a little bit at the end about the long-standing brand of Primetime Sports and the Friday Roundtable. Monday roundtables are going to continue. Of course, Tim and Sid start on Monday, so a lot of great things happening coming up. But we left a little hockey talk for you, Elliot, about...
First of all, can I just say, let me just apologize. I was late. It was...
Yes.
There is, Gordy, someone who I started with is your intern. There is something fitting to me being late to the last ever show of Primetime. There is something to that because I used to be late all the time. Sorry about that. This one was unavoidable, but it still sucks.
Anybody who drives around the city understands exactly what just happened.
Well, there was an accident. I couldn't. But the worst is, like, you get people like Jeff as a party texting you, like, way to ruin the final round table.
That's my ass.
I do remember when you're starting to make inroads as an intern and then now a big time broadcaster, but at The Fan, your first headline back when there were all those media columns, Rob Longley in The Sun, Chris Elkovich in The Star, and Bill Houston in The Globe and Mail. I mean, these media scrutiny columns, your big headline was Friedman suspended 5 days.
It was Friedman takes Fan heat.
Cause you showed up late for another show.
Yes,
correct?
I was late.
Yes.
And I got into, and I tried to say thanks, and the other person exploded on me, and I gave it back to them, and I got suspended, which was not wrong. I kind of deserved it.
But it was the headline on the media column.
I know. And then when it showed up in the paper, I was like, this is not good.
But
was it an on-air incident?
No, it was the swearing was off-air. I don't think I could have survived
it
that.
It was for an on-air show.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. It was and Elliot arrived late.
I was late. Okay. And I deserved to be punished for that. And then it turned
not to
a
have
bit
it
nasty.
Headlines. Fortunately, you've had many other accolades since then on the positive front.
Oh, man.
So
those were the days.
Yes, yes, yes. So a couple of quick things. When we talked about the Toronto Maple Leafs, we're not just going to talk about the Toronto Maple Leafs, but, you know, given... putting context into the past week and then the big picture about people saying maybe they're not physical enough, maybe they're not strong enough defensively. Do you get concerned about that at all? Or is it the same as it was before game number one?
I don't know how you couldn't be concerned a little bit after what you saw last night. Like, I'm not a guy who overreacts to one game or freaks out, you know, 5 games into the season. That's not my way. But look, you know, it's a team they've got to beat. Tampa's going to be on the road through the Stanley Cup final. They were embarrassed themselves on the weekend, and they came in here and they tore them apart over the second half of that game. And, you know, I think that, you know, just asking around today some people, what did they see when they watched that game? It is the same thing that they would have said about the Maple Leafs coming into the season. If you pressure their defense, they're not going to be able to stop you. And that is something they are going to have to correct sometime now, between now and the second week of April.
Well, what do you mean by pressure their defense? Like physically pressure them, or just because, I mean, it's a defense that is fairly mobile.
Force them to make decisions.
Should be able to move the puck in a fairly efficient way.
I think it's a couple of things. I think A, there's the physical nature to it. B, the lower you keep them in their zone, the more you feel that you can win battles with them and cause them problems. And there's also a feeling that the forwards don't do enough to help them out. Now, one of the things that Toronto has kind of changed early in this year is they're not doing as many of the long bombs as they used to. So I think it's their way of trying to convince the forwards to stay closer. So it's not just racing down the ice, and if the puck doesn't get there, then everyone's in trouble. But the fact is that teams still are not convinced the commitment level forwards to help out the D is there, and you can expose them.
Taking a look, how about, because we talked a bit about the Leafs earlier, so did you expect that from Patrick Marleau? Not only did he have two goals, he had six shots on net, he had five hits. I don't remember him ever having five hits with Toronto. Not that he shied away from things or not, but...
He did shy away.
Yeah, well, anyway, as far as a San Jose Shark team that had lost four in a row, and you brought up yesterday a point when we were chatting, did you realize Ottawa has San Jose's first pick? So if San Jose came dead last, the Ottawa Senators would... Now, they were dead last yesterday. They won't be dead last, I think, for very long. But that was kind of a... Could have been a turnabout, interesting, fair play. But what a perfect return.
You know, you always wonder the adrenaline in that game. Like, will that continue? It just shows you... What's the old saying? You plan, God laughs. San Jose tells Patrick Marleau in the summer, yeah, you know what? We're not signing you. We like our kids. We want to see what's going to go on. And... you know, we're going to move on. And three games into the season, you know, we're going to sign Patrick Marleau. And credit to whoever figured out that they shouldn't sign him until after they announced they were going to sign him. I think Doug Wilson said we're in the process of signing him. Because if they sign him before that game, his consecutive game streak comes to an end. But because they signed him after the Nashville game, they can keep the streak alive going into Chicago. Well, I thought that was a smart play.
I think they'd be smarter to end the stupid streak. I think Toronto should end the streak. I think, you know, why so much honor for the streak? It's like, get the most out of the player. Maybe he was more effective in his first game because he was rested.
You're very negative this afternoon.
Have you ever talked to a very bitter Gary Unger about Al McNeil sitting? Remember that Al McNeil sitting Gary Unger out to end
still,
the streak?
Doesn't he still have the record though?
Or no, Doug Jarvis.
Doug Jarvis does. Yeah, and Doug Gary Jarvis. Unger will articulate that he is till his deathbed about that the coach of the Atlanta Flames and Al McNeil decided we gotta end this distraction and sat him out of game. And some of the teammates were trying to get him to go on just for a second or two so it would count as a game played, but Al McNeil made sure he didn't because he thought it was a distraction.
I think, Mike, will the Sharks be better off having Patrick Marleau play every night this year?
No, probably not.
Yeah.
I just think that, you know what I think happens? It happened with the Ripken thing.
Bingo.
You know, remember with Cal Ripken's streak, like Ken Rosenthal, who's a big media star in this business, he'd write once a year that this has to end, and the Baltimore players would like threaten to kill him. Like
yeah.
It's,
but it hurt the team.
It did hurt the team.
Yeah,
I just think you know, like you look at Andrew Cogliano. How did his one break? They suspended him for two games, and you remember the firestorm that came out of that. I just think that these things become a rolling mountain. And unless the player is Kawhi Leonard who says, I'm happy to take the night off, I think people don't want to be seen as the person who breaks these streaks.
You might as well part company with the player. I'm just saying, like, Michael, I totally see your point, but you're right. It's one of those things that just evolves and you go, how the hell did we get here?
Well,
it's like being married for 8 years to someone you don't like. And you go, how did this happen?
Yeah. I mean, this guy's out of the NHL.
Yes, they had parted company.
Right?
Everybody had parted company.
In this relationship, the San Jose Sharks had the leverage, so they could easily
But I think there's a respect factor.
We're happy to have you, but you know we're not going to.
But the bulk of the streak he did with the San Jose Sharks. I think any team that would have taken Patrick Marleau, the streak would have been on the table to say understand that he wants to keep it going. You know, so I get it. I also get that because we're talking about load management earlier and just saying veteran players like that would have been the kind of guy in a perfect storm to miss games last year for the Toronto Maple Leafs if you're imposing load management. Right?
No question. But the thing is, and like I said, like Andrew Cogliano and George Parles were roommates.
Mm-hmm.
And their relationship has never been the same since that suspension and his streak. I think that, honestly, whether rightly or wrongly, I think some people worry about the toll it takes on them when they end it.
Okay, Edmonton Oilers. We talk about Canadian teams that we've got negatives and some positives and a surprising positive in the Edmonton Oilers.
So I do a weekly radio hit in Edmonton, and I went on this week and I said, are you guys starting the parade yet? And he's like, you're the third guy today to come up with that line. So first of all, I'm not that original. Secondly, you know, he said to me, the host, Bob, he says, you know, are we overreacting to this a bit? And I'm like, overreacting? You guys have made the playoffs once in 13 years. Yeah, enjoy it.
Go
like,
nuts, yeah.
Go on the ride. You know, the whole thing about sports is you're supposed to enjoy them and have fun. I don't know how good they are. I don't know if this is going to last. But I can tell you this, for a lot of the last 13 years in Edmonton, it beats the hell out of what's been going on. I think they got a win before the season when McDavid showed up. Like this summer, all the rumors were they mismanaged his injury. He's more seriously hurt than they're letting on, and he's not going to be ready to play. And just the fact that he was ready to go on time, it was a huge victory for them.
And he made a point of playing a preseason game,
yes,
which surprised me.
He made a point, and they weren't crazy about that, but they did it. And, I think that shows a lot about him. Like, that's the kind of guy I want to be my captain and my franchise player. I don't know how good they are. I don't know if this is going to last, but good on those fans for having something to cheer about for a week. And you know what? James Neal last year, that was a disaster in Calgary, and it was as much his fault. Like that, the fact that that trade happened showed you how bad it was between the player and the team last year. At least he put in the work in the offseason to make himself better, and it's turned around for him. So far, so good.
Does being on a power play with Connor McDavid, does that help?
You know, I got to tell you, like, if
is that a factor
if
here?
If you're smart enough to know to go to the front of the net and put your stick down,
yes,
you'd be surprised at how many players, Mike, don't figure that out. He's smart enough to know how to do that.
Well, the Calgary Flames also off to a good start, and the only upside about the James Neal confusion about why did we sign this guy if the coach didn't intend to really play him? And one of the big lines was Calgary had a hell of a season. They were number two overall in points and a big come-from-behind win as well. So, I mean, both the Alberta teams doing well.
Both the Alberta teams doing well. Winnipeg, I wonder if they're starting to get their legs after a nightmare offseason in this whole Bufflin thing, which is holding over them.
Yeah, where are we with that now, Elliot? You've reported on as much as anybody.
I was told that one's going to take a while. Like, it might be a month or two until he makes his decision. I've had some guys tell me they don't think he's coming back, but, you know, I was warned last week, don't assume anything.
And pardon me if I missed this on one of your thoughts, but is there any real...
There's a lot of them.
Is there any real insight as to what's holding him back?
Or? His ankle was hurt last year.
Okay.
I don't think it ever got better.
So does he want to put himself through another?
And I think that's what I heard. Like he started skating at the beginning of the year. Like he enrolled his kids in school in Winnipeg. He's there, and he started skating. And he says, "I feel terrible, and I don't want to do this." And you know, you were talking before about sports science. So now we're seeing Matthew Tkachuk doesn't show up at training camp, and he's lights out to start the year. Braden Point doesn't show up, and then he's coming off surgery. His first game, he looks dynamite against the Maple Leafs last night. Like, you were talking about load management in hockey. That's what it's going to be. You don't play. Like, the Leafs are going to cut next year, I think, from 8 exhibition games to 6.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're going to start to see this. Like, I don't need – like, some guys – Patrick Kane, he wants to play. But a bunch of other guys, I could see them saying, we don't want to play. That's what these guys might end up doing. And I'll tell you, if Bufflin shows up in December and he has a good year – after what happened with Nylander last year, someone else is going to try it.
anyway, just before we move to basketball, what's caught your eye in the world of the NHL at odd, Michael?
Well, I don't really, wouldn't claim an expansive view of the NHL, but
like, we're not asking for 31 thoughts like Elliot has.
Do you have anything to say about China?
And the NHL?
No.
I mean, I have some, I find that the China NBA thing to be, you know,
that's the biggest story in sports.
Yeah,
we're not ignoring it.
Anyway, I'm not going to sit here and offer any grand insight on my views.
Go to it. So we just led to it. So why don't we just go to it?
So anyway, it's Stephen Brunt, Gord Stellick, Michael Grange, Elliot Friedman, the final Friday Primetime Sports Roundtable. So when we're talking about basketball, it's interesting about the whole Raptor season without a couple of guys, but also a interesting, controversial, trying to make sense of start of the season as far as the NBA preseason goes and the visit to China.
Well, yeah, the visit to China, but the comments about China on Twitter and China's reaction to those comments, and then a lot of the great flurry of reactions and counter reactions to it, including from the commissioner of the National Basketball Association.
And the president of the United States.
And the president of the United States, because of course he would weigh in. But in a league that has...
waiting for this. Like, he couldn't wait to be asked
but of course
the question.
All he wanted to talk about were Kerr and Popovich, right?
He didn't want to talk about that.
Yeah. I'm going to try and be... do this in as kind of succinct a way as possible. It's about money and power.
Mm-hmm.
And this, and it's kind of a depressing reality, but that's what we're talking about here. There's been a lot of talk about the nuances of Chinese history and culture, and the issues, the colonial history of Hong Kong and the issues of sovereignty, which is all, people should study up, because it's true. And the Chinese feel a way about Hong Kong that we should try and understand probably. And they feel the same way about Taiwan, which we might have to understand one of these days. And all of that is well and good, but this is about money and power.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese, the NBA is afraid of losing any piece of the Chinese market, which is incredibly lucrative for them. They have far more there going on there than any other sports league does. They're doing what everybody else dreams of doing,
mm-hmm.
which is exploiting this great untapped sports market. The NHL wants to get in there. Everybody wants to get in there because there's a billion plus people and people can smell the money. But if you do business with China and you upset China, they will not play nice,
mm-hmm.
and they will not be shamed, and they will not take lightly any comments about what they consider their internal affairs.
And they generally win these disputes.
Well, like, money, because
who backs down?
Because they're holding
who
the
do
chips.
They back down from? And everybody backs down from that country
because of money.
Yep, absolutely, 100%.
And I wish we were arguing about the principles of free speech here and all of that, but we're not. It's not. That's not what this is about. You've just seen somebody's. Where the limits of free speech are, if you're attached to the National Basketball Association, you have reached that limit,
mm-hmm.
because they care more about the money. And, that is a cold, hard calculation. And it wouldn't be just them. Other businesses would do exactly the same thing.
We all have a boss, right?
Yeah.
And I feel terrible for Maury. It's obviously he's in a really bad spot.
He just didn't
know
China was his boss.
Exactly. He was like, is anybody going to argue that he was wasn't trying to do the right thing? He was 100% trying to do the right thing.
It's hard to argue with somebody standing up for free speech.
For people's freedom.
Except there'd be a lot of people in China who said it wasn't the right thing.
Yeah,
I do think one thing it does expose, mm-hmm. is, there's a lot of people who are very principled from their comfort of their Twitter feed.
100%.
Right? Yeah. And 100%. He's no different than any other. Mm-hmm. And, when there was consequences to his principal beliefs, he shut the hell up. and guess what? A lot of other people who are pretty brave in terms of their putting themselves out there as whatever principles they might espouse.
Wait till it's their company.
They shut the hell up too when it affects their mm-hmm. livelihood, their family, their employment, mm-hmm. and whatever else there is. And also, I think there's a lot of people who are, comfortable in lobbing lobbing criticisms at other cultures and are equally comfortable being completely blind to their own shortcomings at home.
Mm-hmm.
People talk about human rights atrocities in China. I'm not versant in them. I accept that there's a reason they're 135th on the list of in that category. But when I don't think you have to dig too hard in the United States or our country to find some pretty atrocious goings on, and. That's I guess what I would say,
it's not
credit.
About that.
Well, it is a little bit.
No,
about
it's not.
That. It is a little bit about that.
Nobody went after him initially because the U.S. is no different. No, that came later.
No.
They went after him purely because their business was threatened in China. Their owner came after him because he knew what that was going to mean. People are making that comparison now. Steve Kerr did that the other day, but it was never about that. It was purely about
right. Well, and but I would also say, actually, Adam Silver, in the context of what he's employed to do, I thought was pretty. He did pretty well. Like, sure, his first statement was a little mealy mouthed and whatever. But when he came out and I watched the press conference from Tokyo before the Raptors game played Houston, and he said, look, you know, this is what we stand for. This is what we would ultimately back our employees' right to speak freely versus our business interests. And we recognize there have and will be and could be consequences to that. And I don't know how much more principled a professional sports league can be. And, you know, and it is a brave stance because half of the league's revenue goes not to the owners, but the other half goes to the players. So you're really, you know, not threatening, but putting on the line to a certain degree, the amount of money that gets 450 players plus the owners get to split. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I actually think Adam Silver overall conducted himself pretty well.
Well, they brought down a cone of silence now over there. They've just killed all media access to the. I'm not going to say it's brave. I think it's expedient, but I'm not going to give him any credit for brave.
I think it's wise, right?
Like, well,
the
other thing too is like, you know, it's one thing for Adam Silver to speak on it, you know, because he is the face of that league and he is the representative of the owners of that league. But, you know, it's not the place of James Harden or, you know, whoever, LeBron James, whoever, like to kind of talk about geopolitical forces and business interests. I mean,
I don't know if I buy that either. Like, people wade into things that they don't know the most about all the time. That's what we do. Like, you know, right. You know, maybe not always in politics, but
right. But what we talk about is trivial.
You know, but I understand that. But you go on Twitter and people, athletes, movie stars, celebrities, media, journalists, weigh into stuff they don't know about all the time. Right now, they're using that as an excuse, and I understand why they're using it as an excuse to say that I shouldn't be commenting on this anymore. It comes back to what you guys were just talking about, and you were talking about, we all have a boss. And there's a lot of people out there who will say, well, go criticize that person as long as it doesn't affect me or hurt me. And we all understand that these are like there was a reporter recently who quit Deadspin. She's like, I don't want to work for them anymore. This is not.
She was an editor, right?
Yeah. What I signed up for. And my reaction was. At least you're taking a principled stand that affects yourself. And she got another job because apparently she's very good at what she does. But I'm okay with that because ultimately you are making a choice that affects you. I understand when people say, I'm not going to do something that affects someone else. It's going to get punished.
It's kind of a refresher about the realities of 2019, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of a one-off tweet. And then all of a sudden a lot of things happened. Everyone kind of assessed and said, okay, that's the reality of 2019, and because it's one the quote old days. If you had an opinion and it was a well thought out opinion, you would still back that opinion, right? Mm-hmm. But as you say on Twitter, responding to something and then all of a sudden, whether it's pressures and that, but you choose to shut it down. Well, then why did you tweet in the first place? Mm-hmm. You know, so
you didn't think
2019.
Well, people forget that. Now you don't decide what becomes a big story anymore.
You already were suspended for 5 days once.
Somebody
watching, okay?
It for you.
Ed, for coming late to a show way back when. We don't want to be late for the break. We are going to come back, and we're actually going to touch on the Toronto Argonauts and CFL football, which we haven't done for a while, but it'll morph well into our final segment. Some memories about primetime sports and the Friday roundtable when we return. Gord Stelick, Stephen Brunt, Michael Grange, Elliot Friedman. You're listening on the Sportsnet Radio Network and watching on Sportsnet 360.
Missed an episode of Leafs Hour? Listen to every episode and subscribe with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan on Demand. Now back to primetime sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Welcome back. The Friday Roundtable continues. Primetime Sports, Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt, Michael Grange, Elliot Friedman. You're listening on the Sportsnet Radio Network. And we'll reflect a little bit on the history of Primetime Sports and the Friday Roundtable, as this will be the last one, Tim and Sid, starting on Monday. We look forward to that. And I filled in with Scott MacArthur doing Primetime Sports for a week in August, and I said, don't throw much CFL my way. I loved the CFL. I've loved the Canadian Football League. I haven't been able to keep up on it. I wondered what the heck they could do with the about the Toronto Argonauts. I found it sad. I did nothing by following them or going to games. And actually, a guy that is a friend of the station and a friend of Primetime Sports, Michael Pinball Clements, out of the blue, just after we had a Conn Smythe chair meeting about who to honor this year and pick pinball. And then a couple of days later, he is the general manager of the Toronto Argonauts.
You know, in Conan, when he was on, when he had his show and they had the emergency guest break glass?
Yeah. Yes.
That's what pinball is when the Argos are in shows. Matt, you guys were talking when I was stuck in traffic earlier about J.I. Albrecht and Sherwood Schwartz. They brought in pinball.
As the human shield.
He got hired as the coach.
Yep.
He retired as a player. That time, too, it was so bad. Yep. They brought him in at that time, and he turned them around. It's sad to watch. As a guy who grew up going to games, too, I don't know what they're going to do.
Seems like a really tall order for pinball. Like, God bless him for taking it on, but, he hasn't been kind of engaged in the nitty-gritty day-to-day.
This wasn't a team that appeared to be very engaged in the nitty-gritty day-to-day.
But in terms of actually, the CFL is such a weird league, right? Because you have to have your feelers out in so many different places for talent.
Yeah.
And that seems to be what distinguishes, it's not like I followed all that closely for a long time, but historically the managers, general managers that were really good were the ones who were able to just find key guys off the scrap heap somewhere, some way, some shape or form, because they knew some undercovered conference, and they would bring in talent. And does Pinball Clemens, does he have those kind of connections? Does he have that network? I mean,
no. I can tell you right. Like, again, sure.
He's been in Canada.
Will he surround himself with good
people? He's been in Canada for 30 years.
That's what he did last time.
Well, he wasn't a conventional coach when they made him a coach, mm-hmm. right? He did surround himself with good people, and and again, he brought something to that team that was very, very, and he also, the reason they put him in there is because he's beloved, and those guys were not beloved, and he inspired some confidence to some degree with the fan base and with the consumers, and and the attitude on that team turned around for sure, and they won a Grey Cup, right? He won a Grey Cup, and so you can't take that away, but. Yeah, he's not a general manager. He's never been a general manager. He's not a personnel guy. But, it's interesting talking to him about it because, he said he didn't want to do this, and I don't actually think he wanted to do this. I don't think, he's been kind of an unofficial ambassador for the team, but he's got a lot of other stuff on the go. They had him kind of trailing the team the last few weeks to see what, to give his opinion about it. The good thing now is that ownership it's stable ownership, so it's not, the Sherwood Schwartz kind of situation. They do have stable owners. They're not going anywhere, but he's going to have, they've got a personnel guy who they're going to keep, and he will be, I think, the de facto general manager in that sense. Michael will oversee stuff. They've been terrible, right? It's actually a good thing in some ways that no one was paying any attention to them in the city because they've been absolutely dreadful the last 2 years, like inept. It's hard to be that bad in a 9-team league. It's hard to be as bad as they've been. And, I his ability to work miracles and make people feel better and have good outcomes is ridiculous. So I'm not underestimating him, and we all love him to death. But, fixing the football team is an incredibly daunting task as a football team. Fixing the institution is a bigger task.
Well, I mean, that's
maybe impossible.
That's still
task.
The question out there, right? Is let's say he does work a miracle and they are all of a sudden, 12 or 14 win football team. Is that gonna
they won two Grey Cups in the last 8 years.
Right. Yeah.
They have.
Yeah, no,
right? They've done it.
But an announced crowd of 9,000 at a great venue. So it's almost like, does pinball give the street cred that, okay,
come to one game. I kind of would, out of respect for him. You know what I mean? It's almost like, because it's that part as well. It's not just the terrible football team. It's the other part that they're a non-entity and a non-factor in actually a really good football environment, if it could be half filled or fully filled.
See, now that there's we were in St. John, New Brunswick earlier this season for a podcast, and what they have done in their junior hockey rink is they've taken out the seats behind one Zamboni and they've made it a social area. You, as long as you have a ticket to the game, you can go down in there, you can buy drinks, you can buy food, and you can chat with people and you can watch the game while that's going on. This is going to start happening in a lot of, you're going to see some of these buildings for younger fans. They don't want to sit in the seats. They want to have like a social event. Now you're seeing, for example, at where the Capitals play, they're going to put in a betting parlor there.
Yep.
The Devils have got something like that there. I don't know if you could do it at BMO Field because they're not going to want you to rip out the seats where they still play soccer. But I do think that if the Argos really want to be the team to try that in Toronto, maybe that's what they do. Because honestly, all these pro teams now, I think Sacramento Kings are going to be doing it. They're taking out seats. The Islanders are talking about it with their new arena. The millennials don't want to sit and watch the game. They want to mingle, look at their phones, and watch the game.
I think the bigger issue is millennials. That's what I would millennials do. In Toronto don't want to watch football.
Yeah, they might. They go to soccer games.
Sure.
They go to the
rugby games.
They go to the rugby games.
I'm just saying, like, you guys could be totally right, and I could be totally nuts. You can't try the same thing. You've got to try something different.
But maybe that's what you do. But, I mean, they've tried a new thing, right? They tried the tailgate. They were at BMO.
Tailgating's not new.
You know, I remember, the excitement was going to be everyone's going to walk over from Liberty Village and watch an Argo game on a sunny Friday night or whatever it was. And, you know, I can just say from my own experience, like my son and daughter, they're now second generation CFL indifferent, mm-hmm. right? So I grew up with the CFL and, was pretty enthused about it, but lost my enthusiasm, 30 years ago, probably, intermittently. You'd pay attention once in a while. My son is a big sports fan. He's never, I don't even know if he knows the Argos exist. He's never raised a question about it. Football's not even on his radar. So, and I think that's true of almost all of his peer group. So,
well, I think if there's 9,000 people in a city of 3 million that are going, he's not in the minority. I'm just saying that it's what's the definition of insanity? Trying the same thing over and over again.
But Elliot,
you've got to try something.
But they've tried. Like, what haven't they tried? Right? Like they've gone from everything. And again,
Steve, until you fold the team, you got to keep trying something.
Well, but they, honest to God, like they did. They had everything from the only legal tailgate that's ever existed. Because it is illegal here, you can't do it. But they did create that at BMO. They went to a new stadium, mm-hmm. which was more football appropriate.
The best ownership group in
exactly. You can go back to the stuff we talked about earlier with Garth Drabinsky and
Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, they have. I'm not sure that there isn't anything they haven't tried.
Stanley Cup champion St. Louis Blues almost moved to Saskatoon.
Yeah,
it took decades, but I mean Harry Arenas bought them for $6 million.
But it's usually an ownership thing, right? And they do have ownership.
Yeah,
that's the whole thing. This is stable. There's no reason, and they're in the right venue. So they could always blame the wrong venue. They could always blame ownership. They've got great ownership, and they're in a perfect venue.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is they're not even close to the only, in St. John, New Brunswick, you're the only game in town.
Mm-hmm.
Here, where are they on the pecking order now?
They've got passed.
Are they fifth?
I put the Wolfpack ahead of them.
Well, the Wolfpack drew more for their big game. Now, I don't know how many those people paid. For their big game than the Argos did for that one where they announced under 10,000 people.
Do you want to bring up, because it's kind of a little bit of reflection, I think of Sportsnet 590, The Fan. We always had a preponderance of CFL people. Don Landry, Pat Marsden, Mike Hogan, Jim Shakey Hunt, who was a co-host for a lot of years on Primetime Sports. And this is the last Primetime Sports. It's the last Friday roundtable. There still will be Monday roundtables, which will be continuing. And first, Elliot, Brunt remembered that Primetime Sports stole the Friday roundtable concept from Damian Cox.
I heard you talk about the cutting edge.
The cutting edge.
Which I was on once, and you guys were all wearing, at that time in the 90s, the non-collared dress shirts were
big.
You guys would all wear those.
So Did you get a gift certificate?
I actually bought a non-collared shirt to wear on that.
So I can't picture what that is.
Oh, yeah. That was the thing.
If like I a show you. Turtleneck?
No. It's like the collars were like, there was no collar like this.
It looked quite good. We weren't on TV either. No. There was no simulcast.
We looked good for radio.
But it was, so then, as I claimed, Damian took it to Primetime Sports and stole it from my old big show in the afternoon. So we had the two round tables. But I guess it started as talking of sports years ago, then became Primetime Sports before The Fan became an all sports station. And Bob McCowan was the guy synonymous with it. My first time I was on, I was general manager of the Maple Leafs. Bill Waters was the co-host. Later on, Shaky Hunt, as we mentioned, was a co-host. We'll have to get, and of course, Stephen Brunt and Damian and others involved as co-hosts, now Richard, but a lot of producers too. So I'm thinking, Elliot, were you a producer first before you actually were on?
No. Okay. So I started in April of 1994 as a volunteer, and I volunteered on yours and Damian's show. And, you know, at that time, you guys did the 1 to 4, and McCown was on in the morning. And the most fun hour on the station was the 3 to 4 crossover with you, Damian, Barb DiGiulio, and Dan Shulman. And then Dan Shulman and Jim Hunt did Primetime Sports. And the producer at that time for Primetime was Chris Clark, later Todd Maclin, later Greg Sansoni, like the top producer would always be there. And, you know, first of all, thanks very much for having me on the last one, because I do remember that I told Chris Clark, like, I love Primetime Sports growing up and I'd love to be on it someday. And Chris Clark said to me, we don't put journalists on unless there's a reason. Dan Shulman's rule was we go straight to the source, and you better have a good reason for putting a reporter on. They have to break a huge story or something big. We're not just putting reporters on for the heck of it. We're going right to the source. So I remember the first story I ever broke in the business was the Bitto family, which owned the Raptors, buying the old post office building, which is now Scotiabank Arena.
Mm-hmm.
And I broke that on Primetime Sports. And I remember I was so nervous that at the end of it, Dan said, Elliot, congratulations on breaking the story, and thank you doing it here on Primetime. And I meant to say my pleasure, and instead I said my problem. And Radar Cunningham, who was the technical director, he laughed his head off. He said, my problem. Like, it was, but it was such a big deal to be on that show. Like, you knew in the job I did that you were really doing good work if you got invited on.
And I'm going to get Stephen to bring up to date some of the modern day producers, but Todd Maclin was the next one. And what I liked about was, and of course, there's no internet then, the big deal that the Olympics signed a huge deal with NBC. Remember, out of the blue, for 4 Olympics. And he gets the two most difficult guys, Dick Ebersole's the head of NBC Sports, Dick Pound, who you can get easily now, but was the head of the IOC. So they're big. And Todd goes back and forth and calls both offices. Now, each office thinks the other person has agreed to come on as long as the other party comes on. So Dick Ebersole thinks Dick Pound's office is in sync and thinks it's a great idea. Dick Pound's office thinks Dick Ebersole's office. And Todd works it all day, and boom, 6 p.m. Eastern time, the two most difficult guys to get are on together. Dick Ebersole, the head of NBC Sports, and Dick Pound. And so I know, Stephen, turn it to you about just, you know, obviously Bob, but other people on the air and other people behind the scenes.
Well, yeah, you mentioned some of the guys producing in the early days. I think Howard Berger produced too. You know?
Yeah, yes, but, absolutely.
But Mike Demergis, Mike Gentile, you know, Ryan Walsh for a long time, Matt Marchese and Jeff Azzopardi most recently. I'm probably missing somebody in between there. But, yeah, the producer's role in that show was to chase down big-time guests for sure, you know, and to manage up and manage down, managers manage sideways. It was a challenging gig for a producer, but some really, really bright people have come through that spot. And some of them are still in this building. You know, Todd Maclin's here, Greg Sansoni's here, you know, Ryan Walsh is here. So there's some of those guys are still around and still part of this organization. But they were integral to making that show work.
Guys like you guys that gave you a chance to shine, Stephen and Michael. You know, I mean, because like we kidded, you're ink stained wretches at one point, the old expression. And Elliot talked about journalists and then being able to get on. And that was really a vehicle that gave you a chance to shine.
Hey, Elliot was a little ink stained, too. He was just, you know, coming out of the.
I started ink stained, but I couldn't get a full time job.
Exactly.
So I got my radio wires crossed, I guess.
But you're right. I mean, it's to the day. I mean, I could almost demarcate my career from, you know, the point where I became worthy enough to be a member, you know, a guest on the roundtable, or to be somebody that Bob McCown would have and call in, you know, as you know, in the for a segment. And you know, it would almost like incrementally from that point on, week by week, month by month, year by year, more people would kind of know who you were. And it wasn't because necessarily the quality of my work had changed, but the way to have it amplified had changed. And you know, and it's a huge privilege. And you know, I told Bob, you know, when I was on with him, I was here for his last show as also. And you know, you thank him, right? You thank him that he wanted to have you on and thought you could sort of not ruin a show. And because it's been a big thing in my career and a lot of other people in the industry.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because there was the couple of years Dan Shulman hosted, which Elliot mentioned. And I know for me, I was the permanent co-host for about 8 years from 1996 to 2004 before I started doing the morning show. And I would take Bob's vacation dates and make sure I wasn't off on them, and did about 6 or 7 weeks and always really enjoyed it. And there's other guys, like you think of the late Jim Kelly out of Buffalo, was a major contributor. Ken Reed, who of course works here. Like, it's funny, there were different guys. Like, you know, it's
John Wells.
John Wells, like you three, you three guys kind of been around, right? Then there's others that, not so much flavor of the month, but were there for a few years, then maybe not so much for a few years. He had like Scott Taylor out of Winnipeg years ago that was one of the guys, you know, in the rotation, about Neil Lumsden, you know, just guys that have, I wouldn't say come and gone, but a real variety of people. Then the staples like Brian Williams that, you know, when he was an iconic voice, would come on, Don Cherry and others.
You know, I just think that it was always a different standard. I remember there was one time Sansoni got mad at me because I had an interview that I'd done with a Raptor, and I listened to it and I was like, this is not that good, so I don't think you should put it on primetime. And Sansoni was like, well, I was counting on this, and I have to find another guest. And I'm like, I'm really sorry, I don't think it's good enough. And I believe that. I believe that you couldn't go on primetime until it reached a certain standard. The same way I feel now still about Hockey Night in Canada. I believe that there is only a certain standard that should go on that show. And I would say to people that this interview isn't good enough. It shouldn't air on primetime. And I believe very strongly about that. I believe that the show had to be treated differently, and only if you reached a certain level should you be on it.
And Stephen, again, moving forward, I mentioned Tim and Sid start Monday, 5 p.m. till 7 p.m., and I know maybe all the details aren't out, but I mean, the journalists from 2 to 5 p.m., guys with a lot of radio experience and a lot of the elements that we came to embrace in primetime will be part of that show.
They will be, yeah, and including, as you said, Monday, the roundtable will be on Monday, which is actually where it started. It was the Monday roundtable.
Well, I told you, Friday was stolen.
Friday was stolen from you, so it'll be Mr. Blair hosting with either me or Richard Deitch, and yeah, it'll be similar to this show in a lot of ways. It'll be in some ways maybe similar to the show Jeff was doing between 9 and 12 as well. So a little bit of a hybrid. But yeah, I think the idea is to hit some of the same notes that this show has hit over the years, you know, journalistically and in terms of the big story, and to try and kind of keep that going. Like Tim and Sid have got a great thing going as well. And, you know, they will be great in this time slot. And I will be listening as I get stuck in traffic on the way home. But yeah, that's what we're going to try and do 2 to 5. That's the idea.
Yeah, well, you know, it's, and you're a veteran radio guy, Elliot, that there's a rhythm to the day. And when you do mornings, you're just reacting to the previous night and you're bang, bang, bang and trying to get some energy in that. Then later on, nothing breaks then. Then the midday show, some things can break and it's the second cup of coffee and that. But the great thing about primetime sports, and will be about Tim and Sid and your show as well, it's kind of a end of day. It's just a kind of a relaxed, and people have talked about it all day. And now let's tune into the fan and get their take on all that's happened. You know, not so much as breaking and all that. And that's something that we will carry on as well. But we certainly do want to pay tribute to all those that have been involved for all the decades, and especially Bob McCown, the guy that steered the ship all those years. So it was great having you guys on board. I thought it's kind of neat being on the last primetime sports show.
It's an honor. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's like we said, it's been an honor being on before, and we will play the music out a little bit, that familiar tune. And who knows when things ever come up again. You never know, right, Brent?
You never know.
I don't mean to turn to you.
Yeah, but you never know better than most.
About how things go. So for Gord Stellick, Stephen Brunt, Michael Grange, Elliot Friedman, like I said, the Friday roundtable, which is done apparently, which says it should be, but the Monday roundtables will return. But like we said, talking all that's going on in the world of sports for the last time. This is Primetime Sports. Good night for Toronto, from Toronto, for Stephen Brunt, Michael Grange, Elliot Friedman. I'm Gord Stellick. Thanks for listening. Listen in Monday. Tim and Sid start 5 till 7 p.m.